It's three for three now, bro.
Yeah, but how come you're not sitting next to me?
The problem with this whole wireless thing. All right. The House Committee on Education will come to order. Today is Tuesday, December 14th, 2010. It is our last opportunity to meet together as this particular House Ed Committee. There's a lot of things we don't know. I'm pretty confident that the legislature will continue to discuss educational issues going into the next session. And we are very fortunate this afternoon to have the Interim House Business and Labor Subcommittee on Workforce Development with us for the first half hour. We have a relatively long agenda today. We promise to keep you very engaged and interested in what we're doing. And because of that, we ask that you turn your cell phone all the way off, not just to vibrate, but all the way off. That way it does not interfere with the sound system for all the millions of people in the world that are watching what we're doing this afternoon. Many of you have requested items on the agenda today. That is why we have a lot to do, and I'm going to try to keep us close to schedule as we move through that. At the end, this is our stack of bills to be introduced as committee bills today. You all should have gotten a note about a week and a half ago that this is an all-come meeting. Bring your bills in. Some folks might want to speak to their drafts. Other people may not, and we'll talk more about that when we get to the end. Are there any comments before we get moving to the first item on our agenda today?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on behalf of the Workforce Subcommittee, I would like to thank you and your committee members for allowing us to meet in a joint session today, as well as committee staff for accommodating that. We have repeatedly run into issues where workforce and education overlap, and our interests, I suspect, are similar, if not identical. And I particularly want to recognize the yeoman's work that both Representatives Dembro and Huffman have done in this regard, and have been very beneficial to our subcommittee in bringing some of the work that you've done before us, and very much appreciate this opportunity. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you for the good idea and for coming. And with that, I will open a joint information hearing with the Interim House Business and Labor Subcommittee on Workforce Development on the Career and Technical Education Collaboration Task Force. And so I think we're going to have at the table Representative Dembro, Deborah Barnes, and Carolyn, is it Becek?
Becek.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Madam Vice Chair. I'm Representative Michael Dembro from House District 45, Northeast Portland, out to Park Rose. And it's my pleasure to kick off this presentation on the work of the the Task Force on Career Technical Education Collaboration. That was created by a House bill from the 2009 session, House Bill 2732, coming out of the Business and Labor Subcommittee on Workforce. And just to give you a quick background to where it came from, on the Workforce Committee, we were hearing testimony after testimony from people from the labor community, from industry, decrying the lack of what used to be called vocational education in our high schools and in our middle schools as well, to be honest. And there was a statement made by one of our committee members that, well, maybe we can, you know, if we can't afford to have full-blown CTE programs in every one of our high schools anymore, maybe we can have more partnerships with community colleges or, you know, with business, with industry. And that made a lot of sense to us as a committee. And so we decided to write a bill and to try to pass a bill that would create a task force that would do a kind of status check on what kind of partnerships are out there currently and what more could we be doing. That bill did eventually pass, and the task force was created, and it brought together really a great group of people. The task force, I was the House representative on it. Senator Rosenbaum was the Senate representative on it. The task force was chaired by Deborah Barnes, who's to my right, a teacher in the North Clackamas School District. And the co-chair, vice chair, was Carolyn from Oregon Mentors. And we, as we worked with the Department of Education, the Department of Community Colleges, and Workforce Development, we did see that there are a number of partnerships in place, but there is definitely room for a lot more. And as we explored the issues, we saw that, you know, career and technical education is not your old vocational ed. It's not your old shop. It's really a very different thing. And it is an extremely successful way of teaching and learning. We discovered that the graduation rate for students who are in full-blown CTE programs is in the mid-90 percentile. And, you know, as you know, for students as a whole, it's much lower than that. This is a method that works because it's an engaged form of learning. And Deborah will talk to you a little bit more about the methodology of that proficiency-based kind of education. We ended up also discovering that there is a lot of desire on the part of business and industry to be supportive of CTE and to lend their expertise, their facilities, and a number of other ways in which they could support the endeavor. We ended up coming up with a report that included five key recommendations. And in the at your dais, you should have a packet that includes the executive summary. It's just a two-page overview of the results of the task force. And it includes the five key recommendations. And Carolyn and Deborah are going to elaborate on them. Unfortunately, Dennis Boyd, who is also a key member of the committee, who is he's with the Sheet Metal Workers Apprenticeship Training Center. He's sick and couldn't be here, but he would have loved, I'm sure, to talk to you about particularly the work of the Centers of Excellence. So you'll see that these five recommendations, which are start in the middle of the first page. First of all, investment in CTE programs of study, that we need to find a way to reinvest in CTE everywhere. Second, and this is especially important in the short term when there's obviously not a lot of resources to offer a lot of programs, we need to figure out ways to partner. And one of the key ways to do it is through regional centers of excellence, where different schools or even school districts are coming together, partnering with their community colleges or just through the school districts to create regional centers for learning. The third is that we take advantage of partnerships between high schools and community colleges directly, using a variety of accelerated learning options in order to get students started in the high schools and be able to move towards certification after they graduate. The fourth is the expanded CTE learning opportunities with multiple partners. That is that to be successful, CTE programs really need to be wraparound kinds of programs that include mentorship and summer skill building, introducing middle school kids to CTE so they see that as an option for them when they get to high school. And they do that through summer programs, which can also have the benefit of improving their, let's say, for example, their math skills. Students who have not done that well just in straight book learning, but through applied math, that brings it all together for them. Those kinds of expanded learning opportunities are also very key to success, and they require partners as well, and Carolyn will talk more about that. And then finally, there is a need to get the word out there about what a successful option CTE is, to let parents know that this is not a lower track kind of option for their kids, that in fact the exit requirements are the same for CTE programs as they are for college-bound students. It's just the learning happens in a different way. The word about that needs to get out to parents, it needs to get out to counselors, it needs to get out to the community as a whole, and we need to figure out a way to do that. So these are the five sort of high-level recommendations that came out of the task force. And now I'm going to turn it over to Deborah to tell us more about her work in this field and also some of the insights that she helped us come to as part of this process. Oh, and let me just say also at your dais you have this new brochure that came out of the U.S. Department of something or other. And I should say, by the way, we have somebody from the Department of Education here who is a task force member, Laura Roach. She is, I know that agency, it's called the Oregon Department of Education.
That was a great segue, Representative Bro.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Barnes. I have taught broadcasting and digital media at the Sabin Schellenberg Center in the North Clackamas School District for the past 17 years. Prior to that, I was a broadcast reporter in Oregon and gave it up because I thought it was time to give back. Sabin Schellenberg is one of the only career and technical education skill centers in the state of Oregon. For nearly 40 years now, we have had students come into our programs. Right now, we have about 20 different programs ranging from fire science, law enforcement, health services, early childhood development, and many, many more, where nearly 3,000 of our school students from the three high schools in North Clackamas come out to our facility and take one of our classes. They receive college credit, in many cases credit for proficiency credit. And 97 to 98% of our kids who come out to Sabin Schellenberg graduate. What a wonderful piece of data to share with you, where kids are actively engaged with hands-on learning. Kids in my class right now, in fact, are working on a project where they become law firms, where they understand First Amendment rights and responsibilities of students, go to Supreme Court cases and figure out why decisions are made for them as reporters, for them as students, and as higher order thinking, which is what we want all of our students to be able to do. It's an investment that the North Clackamas School District made 40 years ago and continues to do so today, even with budget cuts, because they see kids actively engaged in their own learning, actively saying to themselves, I'm learning something, I don't have to ask, why do I need to know this? They pick up college credits. In my case, the kids in my program after 3 years pick up 15 college credits through Mount Hood, no, this year through CCC. What you need to know, if you've never been in a CTE class, let alone a class at the North Clackamas School District at Sabin Schellenberg, is kids want to be there. This morning, when I walked in, I had two kids standing outside at 7 o'clock. They wanted to be in the classroom. Tonight, our kids will leave at 7 and 8 o'clock at night. Why? Because it's like a real workplace. It's not like a classroom. They are treated like professionals. They act like professionals. There's no disciplinary problems. Why? Because they get off the bus and they become adults, young adults who want to learn, who believe that this is their right to be actively engaged in their own learning. I know we don't have money, but yesterday at the Business Summit, what you heard was we've got to get people prepared for real jobs for the future. Many of our college graduates don't have jobs today. but our state is looking for people who can be in manufacturing positions, engineering positions, construction business. And those are the kind of classes we teach at Sabin Schellenberg that we have to invest in now, because every one of those kids sees themselves having a future, whether they go on to college or an apprenticeship program, an internship, community college, or a four-year university. Their options are much wider than many other kids. I know it's tough financially, but I'm very proud of my own school district, who in the middle of a $15 million budget cut next year, instead of saying, let's close Sabin Schellenberg, they're trying to find ways to make sure that 3,000 kids can come into that program every year. Why? Because it's proven itself. It works. Kids are actively engaged in their own learning. I'm really concerned that this isn't something that can't be shared with other kids around the state. Think of those kids in Klamath Falls or Tule Lake or Bend or Salem or Redmond, who, if they had the same kind of facility that partnered with a community college or business and industry, every day they'd go to school saying, I get it. I want to be here. I want to stay in school. I don't need to drop out because my education is relevant to me and my future. If we really truly believe in the kids and what we want them to have in the future in this state, then we have to have facilities and classes like this. We have to have CTE as a supplement for paper and pencil and pen and forms and books, because the difference is a kid who can make something, who can build something, who can produce something, learn something, and it retains so much longer than a test where they fill in the bubbles. That's important in this state, but what's really, really important is we give kids more than just the stuff that they can learn in the comprehensive high schools. Together we partner. Together we work together, and we have a better chance of keeping those kids in school. And I think that's what the CTE Task Force, and I've been on three of them now, has said time and time again. We never have money, folks. But one of these days, finding some resource to partner with comprehensive high schools and CTE schools may be the ticket for fewer dropouts in this state, which is what we all want for every one of our kids. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
May I interject a question, please?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Deborah, do you partner with any outside groups or organizations like union apprenticeship programs or anything at all?
Yes, we do. Every one of our classes has advisory panel members. That's part of the money we get from Carl Perkins, and through the state, we have to have advisory panel members. In my case, AFTRA, American Federation of Television Radio Artists, is the union that represents my advisory panel. But in every program, we have somebody from business and labor on our panels. That's what we have to have. And those are the great connections where our kids actually get to go out in the field and do internships. So for every CTE class around this state, that's part of what is expected.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me, Representative Gelsner. I'm Carolyn Beslick. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Mentors. We support 90 mentoring programs throughout the state, which in turn support about 35,000 youth with a caring adult mentor. When I'm talking about children, I'm talking about children anywhere from 6 to 25 years old. But there are many middle school and high school programs who have mentors who interact with children on a regular basis. And so I was appointed to this committee to represent the nonprofit sector and to talk about the importance of that sector, because as we all know, as busy as high school and middle school counselors are with their caseload, they don't get a whole lot of time to talk with parents and children about the future education of those children, and that of course is a big part of the dropout problem. Oftentimes nonprofits take up the slack. There are places like Self Enhancement Inc. in Portland where the parents trust that organization and the parents go to that organization for advice on how to raise their children. So I don't think that the nonprofit community knows enough about CTE and about the fact that it's not tracking to a low-wage, go-nowhere job, that it is all about different kids learning different ways, and CTE can be a great way to help parents understand that this is going to lead to a high-wage job that may be a two-year degree or maybe a four-year degree. But when we know that so many of our kids of color are dropping out, how do we make sure that their parents are in it for the long run, are going to push those kids to make it through high school because they know that there's a job at the end of the day. So for our part, I think the nonprofit community has to get much more savvy about understanding CTE and advocating for it, both at the high school and the community college level. The second thing I want to speak to is those summer school and after school opportunities. We talked a little bit about the ACE program with United Sheet Metals Worker, but there's another ACE program called the ACE Mentoring Program that is 28 different firms in downtown Portland that are architecture firms, construction firms, engineering firms, and they have an after-school mentoring program that pulls kids from literally 20 high schools as far away as Banks for a five-week after-school mentoring program where kids work in groups with two adults, young professionals, and four kids, and they decide a plan. They design a bridge or a skyscraper or a city park, and they get exposed to all of these careers, and after 5 weeks, they present what they've done to their parents, teachers, and other youth, and it's an amazing program. So many of those kids go on to get either a 2 or a 4-year degree in one of those industries, and it's all free. The kids are responsible for transportation, but the man hours are those mentors from those 28 firms collaborating to build a curriculum and to engage students after school. That's a pretty intense example, but there are job shadows, there are opportunities for kids to get to places of work, to understand what happens in a hospital, in the healthcare field, and all the fields that we know are high wage and high demand. And as an organization that has a board of 30 business members on it, I can tell you, they want to engage. We just need to show them a path, and we need to show them that they can interact with the schools in a way that makes sense. So those are the points that I want to share with you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. Are there questions for this panel?
No,
we did a good
job.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
And you may have stated it, but I heard time and time again about dropouts versus maybe many kids were saved from dropping out because they entered some of these programs. Can you give us an idea of how many out of a pool? I'm just wondering how much it is really affecting the dropout rate in Clackamas.
I can, talk to you, I'm sorry, Representative Geller and Representative Thatcher. I can talk to you about Sabin-Schellenberg, and for the most part it's very similar to the state. 97% of kids who complete at least 2 years of a CTE program consecutively will stay in school and graduate. Right now in the state, you're looking at a 30% dropout rate.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And if you can invest and get 97 to 98% of your kids to graduate, why wouldn't we invest in it?
Can I just follow up?
Yes, please.
How many kids are we talking about are served through this?
This year we have 3,000 students from Rex Putnam, Milwaukee, and Clackamas High School. At one time, Sabin-Schellenberg was a regional center, and we opened our doors when the legislature gave us additional funding, and we had kids from Canby, Oregon City, West Lynn, and several other school districts, because the school districts didn't have to give up the FTE. Got those kids on the buses, and we had kids in all of our programs.
And just to follow, so most of these kids were in danger of dropping out before?
Not necessarily.
Or just some? Okay, so it's hard to say that out of 3,000 this year, that 97%, whatever that works out to be, were safe from dropping out. It's just how many would you say were in danger of dropping out of, let's just say, this year's enrollment?
I don't have data, but I can tell you that in my class I have a 4.0 student, and I've got a student who's got something around his ankle.
Right.
And I can tell you this, when I have those two kids sitting together, they're the same demographic. They don't see each other as a 4.0 and a kid who's got problems. They work together because they have the same goal to get a project completed. So for me, that means I have 100% kids who are going to graduate out of my program because they don't see themselves differently. Remember, these are three different high schools, and these kids are coming together. They're not the Cavaliers or the Mustangs or the Kingsmen. They're kids who go into a Sabin-Schellenberg class and learn professional skills and workplace skills. And for them, completing a project means they want to be there.
Mm-hmm. Really exciting.
Yeah, if I could just follow up, you know, I think that The students who are successful in these programs are successful for a couple of reasons. One is that method of teaching. I think that applied learning just works for a lot of kids. Another is that they really have a sense of personal contact, the kind of thing that Carolyn was talking about, but also they see themselves as part of a cohort, a team working together. The ACE Academy is a really interesting one because what that does is it draws students from, I think it's four different school districts, and they remain enrolled at their resident district. They are from, you know, Reynolds or Centennial, and that's where they're graduating from. But for half of their time during their school week, they are at ACE, and they're doing their applied learning. And actually, in the middle of their architecture class, they're doing math, and that's how they're getting their math proficiency. And they're doing their writing through field reports and things like that. It's a very interesting kind of model. So when they graduate as from their home high school. Many of them play sports for their home high school. I was able to go to their first graduation, and one of the class speakers, a young woman, is going to the University of Oregon, where she's going to major in, I forget what, education or something that had nothing to do with what she was doing at ACE. But the way that she was learning at ACE just really worked for her, and the teamwork really worked. And so, I think it's really important that we do as whatever we can as a state to encourage this mode of learning. ACE had a really hard time getting off the ground because it was a charter school sponsored by multiple districts. The charter school law is written so that one district a charter school is sponsored by a district, and a charter school has to have a minimum of 25 students. Well, ACE doesn't really have any students. Its students are all resident at their home high school. So they've had to jump a number of bureaucratic hoops. And one of the recommendations that came out of the task force is some legislation that's going to change that to make it easier for districts to partner to sponsor charter schools. So you'll hear more about that. And there'll also be legislation coming out of it, essentially telling the Department of Education, find ways to implement these recommendations to the extent that you can. So you'll be hearing more about those as well.
And I hate to bring this to a close because this is a great topic that is deserving of vastly more than 30 minutes of time. Are there any final questions or comments, Representative Witt?
Well, Madam Chair, I was I'm interested to learn if your committee has any legislative intentions along these lines, because I know that our subcommittee would be interested in that. So,
and I am not entirely familiar with everything that is in this enormous stack in front of me. I believe a couple of the concepts that Representative Dimbrough mentioned may be in this stack.
Actually, they're not.
Yeah. But it's my understanding that some of those concepts would be coming to this.
They certainly would be coming through this committee, probably.
Through this committee or this similar committee, whatever.
And we would like to be as supportive as we possibly could be.
And likewise, I think maybe we could jointly make a recommendation that on these issues, that the committees that are similar to ours have the opportunity to work together.
Thank you.
On them.
Thank you very much.
And I just have to say, it's wonderful to have a task force and to hear this update in my community of Corvallis. I'm very proud of the very strong technical program we have at Corvallis High School. We collaborate with Lynn Benton Community College, and our voters just recently approved the extension of a local option levy, which helps to pay for some of those things. We've got kids doing welding. We have kids building houses. We've got a fabulous auto shop program that we have down there, Metals Woods, and it really does keep so many of our kids engaged. And even looking at our theater program, it's much like what you described. I go into that room and see kids that I would never see together in a room, and they're all finding the value that they each have to each other and what they can each contribute. So it's just such a phenomenal thing on so many levels, and we really need to do a better job making sure that all kids have access to all types of learning experiences, including career and technical education.
Thank you. Madam Chair?
Yeah, Representative Huffman.
It might be an appropriate time, it may not be, to ask Commissioner Avakian, and I had talked, and I know he's talked to others, about a related bill that may proceed. Do you know if we have it in a in this policy committee, or Representative Witt, are you familiar with how that bill may proceed?
If it is Commissioner Avakian's bill, that would probably be introduced as a statewide officials bill that would then be referred through the regular process. I don't believe that that bill is in this. You've read all the bills in the stack. Or sort of.
Matt's here.
No.
No, we haven't.
Yeah, Kate is here.
Kate is here. Kate, would you like to come up very, very briefly?
But this is...
Just to give us an update so that we, you know, we know that the bill is coming.
Okay. I'm certain there would be more than that.
Thanks, Kate.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Commissioner Avakian does indeed have a... Oh, sorry, Kate Newhall with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I guess it's been a while since I've been sitting before you doing impromptu testimony. Mm-hmm. Commissioner Avakian does have a bill very similar to the bill that he had in 2009, and as soon as I am done giving you all testimony on religious clothing in the classroom, I will be dropping that bill as an agency bill, and I'll have a bill number that I can actually share with you all. I just don't know what it is until I have filed it, and that comes immediately after this committee.
Great. Thank you very much. And Cheyenne just made an important clarification. The bills that we're introducing today as committee bills are obviously the pre-session filed only bills. There will be a whole other round when we come back together, and both agencies and individual members, all of the bills are now coming out, and we get to start the fun of tracking them all down and figuring out where they all go. So thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Witt, for coming and sharing this topic with us, and Representative Dimbro for the work that you've done, Representative Huffman. And with that, I will close the joint information hearing with the Interim House Business and Labor Subcommittee on Workforce Development.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks for coming. And I am now going to open an informational hearing on the Oregon School Facilities Task Force report. And we have a brief 10-minute report from Elise Brown, Luis Caraballo, and Bruce Murray. And you can come right. Oh, sorry. Yes. Welcome.
Welcome, Chair Gelser and committee members. I am Bruce Murray, 4110 Southwest Patrick Place in Portland. I am a board member of the Center for Innovative School Facilities. And while now retired, my working career included 25 years as a commercial banker financing real estate developers. No way responsible for current conditions, of course. retired long before. And then I spent 3 years as a director of real estate for the Chicago Public School System when Mayor Daley took over in the 1990s. First and most important, please accept the Center's thanks for your leadership in the 2009 legislative session when you authorized the creation of the School Facility Task Force and gave it the charge to measure the problem and recommend standards and funding mechanisms. We very much thank you for this strong leadership. As a member of the board, a not-for-profit, you remember the Center for School for Innovative Facilities is a not-for-profit with more than 100 volunteer real estate design, construction, and industry professionals like myself. I can assure you that you made the very difficult job easier with your legislation. I would like to take a couple minutes to give you some background on the issue. First, the Center's mission is to advance student performance by improving place and community. We are clear that quality teaching is the most important component of education. We are also clear that quality facilities impact achievement, and more importantly, are the rising tide that lifts all boats, improving both teaching and learning. Our statewide focus is twofold: assisting school districts in making facility improvements that have the most impact on achievement, and second, energy conservation that saves operating dollars, thus freeing funds for the classroom. Oregon, unlike most other states, has virtually no support for school facilities. The Center has determined to change that situation, but not at the expense of the classroom. Rather, we are determined to establish a program and separate funding for facilities that augments rather than steals from education funds. Oregon students equally across the state deserve to learn in the environment that strengthens their achievement. Our second focus, saving money in operations. Buildings built before 2000 that have not been retrofitted are energy hogs. Oregon school buildings total about 94 million square feet. In current language, as 1,600 football fields. The money spent operating these buildings is better spent in our classrooms. The State Facility Task Force you established has worked diligently over the past months to develop a path for change. Their plan, completed this past spring, breaks this very large and complex charge down into reasonable and doable pieces. The center, as a group of volunteers working to help Oregon school districts, are strongly supportive of the plan the task force has developed and are encouraging its completion at every opportunity. We urge their continued work for two reasons. In May, Oregon voters passed measures 68 and 69, adding K-12 school facilities to Oregon's bonding authority, and Governor-elect Kitzhaber is proposing a school weatherization fund. Both actions are good news for Oregon's cash-starved school facilities. However, Oregon's bonding capacity is limited, and tight budgets and deferred maintenance over the past two decades have created a backlog of school districts with urgent facility upgrade needs. Unlike most states, we have no publicly accessible inventory or database with which to set priorities for state bonds or any other school facility funding mechanism. Specifically, Oregon needs an information inventory database that will capture the size of the problem and provide a baseline for distribution of funds in a transparent manner. It is logical and essential that decisions on the allocation of funds for facilities be data-driven. Without data and with the extreme backlog of need, litigation inequities will be difficult to avoid. With these comments, let me turn the mic over to Luis Caraballo, Chair of the State School Facilities Task Force, to discuss with you the progress and the promise for the future.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Chairperson Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Luis Caraballo. I am Director of Facilities and Planning for the Salem-Keizer Public Schools, and I am the current chairperson of the, as we refer to it, the House Bill 2013 School Facilities Task Force. We are just coming upon our first year anniversary in existence. It's been a roller coaster experience for those of us that are in the business. We came out of the chute working very hard to try to meet the overwhelming charge given to us through the House bill, and I think we have been in front of no less than a half dozen committees at the legislature hoping to be able to move that agenda. At the end, the resources that were also to be allotted to us have been redirected, and we clearly understand why. Those of us that are in the day-to-day facility business, we're accustomed to it. We know, as a public school district, what it also means is we're having those very uncomfortable discussions at our level about how we're going to balance our budget as part of our piece of the action, as it would be, so we completely get it. However, we've been undaunted by that issue because this issue is so important to school districts and to our communities. And the task force, through its many volunteers, which represent members both in the school systems as well as members of industry, architects, engineers, and so forth, have opted to at least continue in several areas to be productive. First and foremost, we're going to continue to pursue asking for a request of the extension of the life of the task force without resource beyond its current life, which is slated to sunset at the end of next calendar year. We're also going to ask the key members that were not included in the original piece, in particular the Oregon Department of Education, also at least be added to the composition because they are a key player in terms of setting the educational policy that drives the components that for which we live on a day-to-day basis. Secondly, we are going to continue to work with the Oregon School Boards Association and others on trying to develop some educational norms against which we can create a metric to measure what the conditions of our buildings are. It's fascinating that when we were asked to go out and assess what the status of our buildings were, what we wrestled with was what barometer would you have us use? Each of our districts is different, and we all define at a localized level what our individual norm is, but there is no statewide defined norm of what we should find in all of our buildings at each level, so that we can have some continuity of expectation as well as of measure. So we are continuing to work both with the center and with the School Boards Association to try to develop some of those metrics against which we can measure into the future. Also, as Bruce has stated, we are looking towards issues of the passage of Measure 68. It's clear that for you folks to talk about what kind of a corpus you should set in terms of bonding authority, that you need to know what the scope of the problem is. As one just soft set of data points that I would give you is, as I look at our district and I look at what the Portland Public Schools are proposing in terms of repair and renovations of our districts, we were successful 2 years ago in securing a $242 million bond, but our defined need was well over $500 million. And as you've read in the media, Portland Public Schools themselves is looking at a $500 million bond initiative possibly in May to try to deal with some of their issues. And that just simply is two key districts in the state. And we are representative of the failing infrastructure in our schools across the state, and we really would like to help quantify that so that as you decide what kind of money you would like to invest, it would be meaningful for both the large and the small districts. Again, the other piece that we would emphasize is that we do need a repository of whatever information exists out there in a singular place so that all of us can use it. At the moment, we all struggle every time we want to go out and talk to our local communities about our needs. Again, because we have no comparative data, it would be very, very useful to collect that in a singular place so that, again, we can use that both for the advantage of smaller and larger districts so that we can have both, you know, apple-to-apple and orange-to-orange comparisons. And lastly, we would say to you from the task force that we are going to continue to be your conscience on this issue. We really applaud the initiative of the legislature last time around that you came to put this really proactive policy in place, because what our research has shown is that numerous states, California, New Jersey, Kentucky, Tennessee, have been in the same place as an outcome of judicial determination. And we would rather not be there. We would rather have the proactive discussion. It allows for both you and us at the localized levels to forge good policy positions on resolving these issues. And so we'll continue to put this issue in front of you with the hopes that we can in the future find resources to help us do the kind of job which you had asked us to do originally in the House bill.
Thank you very much. And we are over time, but if we have brief questions, we could entertain those now. Representative Roblin, do you have a question?
No. If I did have to ask one, repeat because I was late.
Are there any questions?
Representative Hall. Thank you, Chair Gelser. A point of clarification, and I distinctly remember this bill when we originated it, and is my understanding funds have been allocated for this study already, or the study is just in initiation stages?
Chairperson Gessler and Representative Comp, the monies were put into a fund as an end, from an end fund balance of the lottery, and we have attempted to come to the emergency board to secure their allocation a couple of times and has never occurred. And at this point, our understanding is that probably legislation will be sponsored to redirect that fund for other uses and will not be made available to the task force.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for your work on the task force. And with that, we will close the informational hearing on the Oregon School Facilities Task Force report and open an informational hearing that is an update from the Task Force on Education, Career Preparation, and Development, House Bill 3619. Representative Kopp is going to come and lead us through the lesson today. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, Committee. For the record, my name is Betty Comp, and I serve as House District 22 representative. It is my pleasure to sit between two people that have been working very hard on education issues, and I won't share how long they've been working on that. That's at their discretion. But for many years, and are experts in their field. Vicki is the head person at Teacher Standards and Practices, which most educators all know what TSPC is, and Bob is now, Dr. Turner is now working at the president's office up in PSU, but had been at Western Oregon, my alma mater, for many years. And so last February we passed a bill that said, well, what do we need to have the best teachers, not only in the nation, but the best teachers in the world? And how can, what is being currently done, and where do we want to go? We formed a task force that was made up of, Bob and Vicki can probably tell me if I'm missing folks, but OEA was there. Oh, good. And what beyond that, we had public and private deans of schools of education from the chancellor's office, COSA, all the folks that we see here, Dr. Kate Dixon from Chalkboard, Dr. Scott Fletcher from Lewis and Clark, Dr. Thomas Green, what a delight. Some of these people have so much in their brain, I'd love just to x-ray it all and see it from University of Portland. And the list just goes on and on and on. And there's very few of us that don't have the word doctor in front of our names, but it was my joy to participate in some of the meetings. And we're talking about standards for our educators, and that means teachers, principals, school counselors. And I really don't want to share much more, but the only thing that I would share is what, when we started our first meeting, we talked about what is already being done. We didn't want to recreate a new wheel if we didn't need to. And there was just an amazing amount of depth of work already being done in this area. And so we had a good foundation to start. And I'm going to leave it up to my I'm not really at their level of being their colleagues, but my learned friends here to share their thoughts and where we are and where we need to go.
Thank you, Representative Cobb. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director of Teacher Standards Practices Commission. And we want to thank Representative Comp for introducing this legislation and bringing us all together, because what we were able to do was bring the work we are doing, some of the national work that's going on, and try to look ahead to the future in how we can improve educator preparation and professional development for our current workforce. So it was really good timing. I know you don't sit on the edge of your seat waiting for National Teacher Education Standards to come out, but they did while we were doing this work. And what's really new and delightful about that is that it is a set of standards that's intended to go from before the educator receives their license all the way through veteran educators. So it ties into the work we have for continuing to be effective in teaching and learning. So there is a level of performance before you get your license, a level of performance when you're brand new, and then a level of performance when you're a veteran educator. So we think it will inform the conversations we are going to be having, we know, about evaluation of performance in the classroom. So some of our recommendations dovetail with that. All the work around that will continue. We're adopting them as standards for teacher preparation licensure programs. The two things I want you to know before I turn it over to Bob is that we made a blueprint for a seamless system, and we attempted to project how much it would cost. So please don't get sticker shock. We did not intend that you would fund all this or that the money would be there, but you would never want to build a house and not know how much it costs. There are a lot of elements of this plan that we can do without funding that are already ongoing, and so I want you to know that we will be moving forward with that. There isn't an expectation that this be funded. We know what the current state of things are, but we did want you to know what we thought the investment in this type of future would look like. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For the record, Representative Gilsard.
My name is Bob Turner. I'm an assistant vice chancellor with vice chancellor in the Oregon University System. I also want to thank Betty Kahn for coming into my boss's office and saying, what can we do to help teacher preparation? This brought together a group of people who represented all of the sectors of education in this state, and the meetings that we had were extremely fruitful and frank, and we came forward with recommendations that I think have very high promise of being effective. I would like to make just a couple of comments. One is that this set of recommendations is based on the assumption that it's necessary to recruit the best, to prepare them extremely well, to support them, particularly in the first year that they're teaching, and to provide professional development as it is needed throughout their careers. I happen to be married to a physician, and one of the attractions to this work to me is that it advocates very strongly for a clinical model of preparation of new teachers. And I would like to also point out that this is not something that is just a dream of mine. The National Commission on the Accreditation of Teacher Education on the 17th of November pulled together a group of 8 states who have formed an alliance to promote the clinical preparation model for teacher preparation, and Oregon is one of those states. The second point I would make is that the recommendations that we are making are very directed and very thoughtful, and I think that the data system piece that you see in front of you is an illustration of that. There is a lot of work going on with respect to data that would follow students from the beginning of their schooling through post-secondary. The data piece that we are requesting in this work is meant to supplement that work, so that we're asking for a very specific type of funding that would feed back very effectively to the teacher preparation programs and let them know the extent to which their graduates are actually promoting student learning. And thank you very much for the opportunity both to serve on this task force and to come here and testify before you.
Thank you. For a little further clarification, I believe you have in front of you the executive summary.
Mm-hmm.
And then, Vicki, did you have this to be handed out, or did?
No, I didn't. But the full report's 56 pages, so I will email that to your committee administrator, and it will be available if you want it.
Thank you very much.
And the next steps for this is there are the 4 recommendations that are given here, but that I will be submitting bill drafts for those recommendations so that we can have legislation that will ensure that Oregon students have the best teachers that they can ever have. And that those aren't ready for us today, but we'll keep you updated as it happens. And the other only comment, and I can't think of a metaphor that fits for this, but I know this whole thing has been kind of what you'd call wonkish and high academic. It was just incredible. The conversations were absolutely incredible. But the goal is that every teacher is prepared to teach every student. And that's just what we want to do in our state. And we've had just an enormous amount of energy and personal research that has gone into the preparation of the recommendations. They are not, I think it could be somebody's PhD, right? It was just exciting. And I want to share my personal thanks for all the folks, the ones I didn't even name yet here, Michelle Hooper, Dan Jameson, Dr. Robert Larson, Marcia Moyer, Beth Pratt, Dr. Hilda Roselli. What a delight. Dr. Turner, Courtney Vanderstek, and Stevens.
Walter Hobart.
Stephen Wohlhode.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's pretty awesome, too, and I think he's only 28 or something. But yes. And absolutely for Dean Randy Hitz. He chaired, Bob started us out, and then the chancellor wanted him to do a little more work in another area. So Dean Hitz has just been the guiding star for all this. And, yeah, the list just goes on and on. And the OEA hosted this and gave us coffee and fruit. I mean, there's just things you just don't know how to say thank you. But it is the beginning step. I feel very proud of our state and the members of these universities and the
system. I mean, it was just incredible to watch everybody from all the different entities say, yes, we want to do this and we want to do it together for our teachers.
Thank you for your leadership on this, Representative Comp.
It's fun.
I can tell you love it. Are there questions? This is a great opportunity with some pretty smart people. Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been very excited about this task force since you first brought up the idea last year, Representative Comp. I'm really glad to see that it's starting its work. You know, a few years ago when the State Board of Education was looking at changing the graduation requirements and, you know, was looking at having pieces for proficiency-based learning and looking at where there might be a place for distance learning, and some of us have been talking about a need to bring, you know, alternative project-based learning, as often happens in CTE programs, you know, into place. There is a concern that maybe the teachers who were coming out of our schools of education were not prepared for these new ways of learning, that the way that they were being taught was essentially, you know, replicating what had, that the way that they were being taught to teach was replicating the way that teaching had been, as opposed to the way that teaching was becoming. And I'm wondering, from your initial work with the task force, are you seeing that the schools of education are, you know, really, you know, teaching these more advanced, you know, not just teaching to a test kind of thing, but more proficiency-based, portfolio-based, collaborative learning, you know, et cetera, kinds of modes?
Go ahead. I don't have a comment.
Chair Gelser and Representative Dimbro, Oregon was the very first state in the nation to require all of its teacher preparation programs to complete 2 full work samples on a performance basis in order to measure their pedagogical performance. So we don't allow our assessment of our candidates to happen just based on coursework and then passage of a written test. They have to be evaluated and observed not only by the school personnel who are working there, but that's another thing we do that's unique, but the higher ed faculty who supervise them. So, and with the candidates, it's a 3-way evaluation. I tell you that because this clinical model and their performance and their quality of their student teaching and all of that is the heart of teacher preparations. It's like residency for a doctor. So what I mean by that is that they're not getting a whole bunch of classes and then just based on how they were taught going out and teaching. They're working in schools all the way throughout their preparation, which means as we move to performance base, our programs are moving in that direction, and I'm confident that our candidates can assess students in a quality way, in a performance model, and in academic content model. Does that make sense? In other words, they can assess their skills in addition to their knowledge, and I'm confident that they're doing that well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki, you talked about student teaching. Is that done in the baccalaureate or just the master's part of the program?
Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, you know, in 1989, Oregon required that our public programs go to Masters of Arts in Teaching programs, which means we have very few candidates in Oregon that are prepared in an undergrad baccalaureate program. We still have a few, but it's less than 15% of our candidates are prepared in a baccalaureate program. And so what I'm telling you is that a math person will come out with a bachelor's in math and have a bachelor's worth of content, and then they'll spend 3 semesters in an MAT program learning how to teach the math and the pedagogy and learning how to work in classes and students. So the reason that model's valued over other models is actually our candidates have to have more content before they enter teacher preparation. If you do teaching in a baccalaureate model, you have to sacrifice content to work the pedagogy into the bachelor's degree. And so I think it is an improved model.
Any further questions? Representative Comp, do you have any? We're just about out of time, but if you have a couple of concluding comments.
Representative Gelser, Representative Dembrough, I would like to pick up on one point that you made, and that it has to do with the faculty and the colleges of education, teacher prep programs. One of the features of this particular work and of the clinical model that is particularly attractive to me is the potential that it offers for university faculty to have closer ties to the K-12 classroom. There are logistic and, I hesitate to use the word, financial obstacles to having that operate as it ought, but that is one of the undercurrents of this particular set of recommendations. Thank you.
In closing, what I would share is a little bit on the next steps. This bill was written in February with a completion date by the end of this year. And so the magnitude of this effort was huge in order to accomplish the timeline. And so where we go from here, and we haven't spent much time as a task force saying, well, yes, they had the bill recommendations that we're going to be bringing forward, but we have a data processing or a technology system that I hope that the people in this task force continue working together in different ways to make sure this the vision is going to be taken moved forward. There currently is, well, there wasn't any, we didn't get any funding, did we? We didn't ask for any funding for the task force. Must be why.
I'm so surprised.
Must have been why it passed. But the recommendations that they have, that we're bringing forward, do have a fiscal to them, and we understand the importance of our work, but yet also understand the economic situation. But I look forward to be sharing more next steps, and again, all the thanks for the agencies and people that, and this is where we crossed the continuum. We had K-12, we had higher ed, we had all those people sitting in the same room talking about our students, and so it's all of us that we want to bring forward with these ideas. So thank
now,
you.
Before you escape,
yes.
Representative Maurer has a question, and you can make your question as short as long as you wish, knowing that the mm-hmm. next mm-hmm. item is virtual schools. So that will, it depends on how long you want that conversation to be.
The question is, if you're using a clinical model, I'm assuming it's medicine and not nursing that you're referring to, since your wife was a physician. Residents are, in fact, paid to be trained, as opposed to writing a check or tuition, which is much different than how our current model works. I'm absolutely not opposed to that, because I think that's where doctors learn to be a doctor, is in residency, not in medical school, and teachers learn to teach in the classroom and not sitting in a classroom. It's more of a comment, but you brought up the clinical model term.
Chair Gills or Representative Maurer, yes.
Okay, thank you. Any final comments?
They should be being paid.
Thank you all very much. So I think I'm actually going to shift the next two items. We have a hard at 3 o'clock.
I thought you just told him.
Unbelievable. I know.
So, he's still the chair. It's
been in a couple hours. at 3 o'clock, we have Commissioner Avakian and another member is going to join us for a discussion of religious stress. I think we'll probably have a longer conversation about virtual learning. I just wanted to briefly update you about this other item here, which is the state school fund distributions for children in long-term care and treatment programs, because I think that will be faster and we can devote more time to virtual learning. So there are two concepts that are in the big pile that we'll be introducing as committee bills today. And it really addresses two issues that we've been grappling with for a while. It's been very difficult to untangle. And this is when a student is placed in a long-term care and treatment program like the Perry Center or the Farm Home, and the student is placed there by the Department of Human Services or through an IEP process, everything kind of works fine. The kid goes, they live there, they get their medical treatment, they go to the classroom, they get education.
sometimes students end up in these facilities through a different route. For instance, a student may be in the emergency room because they have attempted suicide, and as a crisis placement, the student is directly placed in, let's say, the farm home. When that happens and the parent's private insurance has been paying because they've not been placed there by DHS or their school district, the wires start to get crossed. And because they are privately placed, there's confusion about who is responsible for providing education services for these kids. So the impact of that has been that there have been some kids in these facilities who have not been getting educational services at all. And what makes it even more complicated is that once the student is there and their insurance runs out, Oregon Health Plan kicks in and starts paying for the treatment, and once that day happens, the student can start attending the class. When the calendar year turns over and the insurance picks up again, the student is then back out of class until their insurance runs out and they go back on to private pay. This is clearly a problem because students need to have access to public education services. So we have two drafts here that are the beginning of trying to address this issue. It wasn't as simple as just saying everybody that goes gets to go to school, because we did not want to open the floodgates for anyone to be able to place their student in a private school and have the public pay for that. We're moving on the assumption that if you're going to a long-term care and treatment facility for mental health issues, you're going for medical treatment. You're not there primarily for the educational services. So the first LC that we'll have later today is LC 1358, and this simply clarifies that all students that are enrolled at a state-approved residential facility are eligible for education services at that facility, regardless of whether the placement is paid for with public or private funds. And we brought in a bunch of business managers from across the state, and what we found was it was very inefficient and expensive to have to be tracking down which day that the student went from one place to the other. So the department would be responsible for entering into the contracts with these organizations and knowing, we know we have this many seats, say there's 50 seats in the facility, we know there might be 150 different kids that go through those 50 seats, but the department is going to fund those 50 seats. And that would just come right off the top of the state school fund, which is the way that it works for the kids that go through the DHS process to be placed there. That would just pull everybody in. The second concept that is there to address this, and if I get any of this wrong, I think I saw Cindy walk in, and you can feel free to come up because I know I'm going to get something wrong. LC 1359 looks at these other facilities which are smaller. They are smaller facilities where you might just have a handful of students. And these are certified or licensed as child caring facilities by the Department of Human Services. When the Department of Human Services certifies a foster home, part of that certification process, or when they certify the farm home or the Perry Center, before they can get that licensure or certification, they have to demonstrate that kids under the age of 18 there have access to public education services while they are there. That is not currently in the statute for these other facilities. So what's happening is that the student may, again, go in one of these crisis situations from the emergency room to this smaller private residential treatment facility. The parent thinks they've done everything right because they've got the student there, but all of a sudden the student isn't receiving any educational services. Nobody's communicated with the home school district, so the parents are starting to get truancy notices for the kids, and the kids are losing educational services. So what 1359 does is requires that residential programs providing services to kids under the age of 18 have to demonstrate how they will provide these comprehensive age-appropriate services, which in most cases will be through an arrangement with that local school district before they can get that certification as a child care agency. It's the same process that is currently used in foster care. And we think these are the first steps. We're pretty sure these are the first steps and maybe the steps that are needed to close all of these loopholes and make sure that all of our kids are getting services even when they're having a mental health crisis. I missed.
Nope. Chair Gelser, Cindy Hunt, Department of Education. I think you described it accurately. I think this would address one of the saddest and biggest issues that we saw was literally two kids shoulder to shoulder in the same classroom, and one day they would be under the public long-term care and treatment program that we operate and fund, and the next day they wouldn't be, and our contractors wanted to educate them both days. I mean, that's the nutshell kind of summary of this, and it would address that where these kids would be educated both days, regardless of whether they were publicly placed or privately placed by their parents.
And I think what's important to point out is that different contractors chose to address this in different ways.
Yes.
So, for instance, the farm home, that contract rests with the Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD. Lynn Benton Lincoln ESD looked at this and, in their words, said they felt that they had a moral obligation to provide educational services to the students that were residing in their district. So they were providing educational services for these students. They weren't getting any reimbursement for it from any place in the state. The opposite response to that was the Perry Center said, we're not receiving any services. We don't think that we are authorized to provide services to these students. So those students actually were not going to class, and we're not getting any educational services. And that was obviously a problem for both of those districts. Then were in a tenuous place. And are there questions about that issue before we...
Nope.
Okay, great.
Madam Chair, I just have a sort of background question. So how did we become aware of this problem? Did it come out of the Perry Center or the Department of Education? I mean, how did this rise to the surface?
We actually had this issue in front of our committee last session, and a lot of people were working on it, and it was very difficult to get we had this on our work session agenda up until the very last hour, and we couldn't get the amendments the right way. After that, I was contacted by the farm home, which is in my district, and they sat me down with their student records and just kind of, without knowing who the students were, obviously, to just kind of show what this looked like in the life of a kid going in and out of class. And since then, we brought a bunch of people around the table to try to figure out how do we do this. And one of the things that came from the business managers, I think that was one of the most interesting things. We actually asked the district business managers to come in. One of the problems was that theoretically right now, the district where the student lives is responsible. But in order for them to pay, you have to follow this paperwork all around the state where you have multiple agencies invoicing each other. And it's so expensive to have that much paper moving back and forth. What we're really doing here is trying to eliminate that, let the department do the administration of that transfer and just really focus on the student getting educational services. Any questions? Great. Representative Huffman.
I was just trying to think. A bell kind of went off up here, and if you had been in my head, it would have been really. But anyway.
Really loud?
With virtual learning, we had directed... What was the process that we went through directing the money to follow the student, and if there was a transfer, that who would have to notify whom on the transfer? It's kind of related.
And we actually have a couple of things that are in the stack that are about really simplifying the process of how do you eliminate really these layers of tracking. You've got a kid, the kid is in a place, the money goes to the kid, to the entity where the student is at, rather than going through five different sieves on the way there. This is kind of a variation on that theme that you'll see in a couple of drafts.
And that was kind of looked at, too.
Yes, so other things that we have in this pile, we have one from this committee, there will be one from the department as well, that has to do with charter schools generally and students in special education, making those students resident districts of the district where they are enrolled in that charter school. In just moments, we'll talk about virtual ed, which in the bill that we're contemplating, virtual schools would no longer be charter schools. They're a whole new entity that we are creating. But there again, students who are enrolled there would be considered residents of these districts. Where'd they all go? That's bad news. All right, great. All right, well, so we'll finish talking about long-term care and start talking about virtual learning. So in your email today, thank you, Cindy. Did you introduce yourself for the record when you came up? Okay, great. And if I want to look at the paper copy, do I mess up your stack if I pull this out?
I can pull it out.
Okay. So Cheyenne, do you want to quickly explain how people can access this on their computer?
I believe everyone received electronically, Madam Chair, members, the link to the S drive that has all the bills that are pending introduction. So if you have a laptop and are able to access the S drive today via that link sent out today, mid-afternoon or mid-morning, they should be available to you there. We've also got
the LCs.
We also have prepared a summary at the dais for everyone basically puts a catch line on the bills that are seeking introduction through this committee today.
And the one that we are talking about right now is LC 2341. And Hannah, do you want to come up just in case as well? So I wanted to give you a little bit of a background in terms of where this came from, how it's structured, what the general ideas are, and then we're just going to let it percolate.
What's the number again? I'm sorry.
LC 2341.
Okay, thank you.
2341. So you all may remember there is an issue we've wrestled with in this committee on occasion related to virtual learning.
Mm-hmm.
We only tackle simple things in this committee. And we had the interim task force met. They made some recommendations. The State Board of Ed met several times, and they made some recommendations. One of the recommendations that was made was to break apart the statute and separate virtual schools from charter schools. And the reason behind that was that we don't want the regulations that are needed for that unique entity that is a virtual online school to impede on the innovation kind of within charter schools. We really want to break those pieces apart. And the dynamics are different in a bricks and mortar school as opposed to a virtual school. The other interest that we heard was, many people talked about the desire to have more opportunities for online learning for students, whether those were part-time or full-time options, whether those were options that were offered by some sort of an entity like an ORCA, or whether those were options that were offered directly by a school district or a consortium of school districts, and for districts to be able to utilize some part-time online learning to expand their learning opportunities for students, whether they were low-demand courses or maybe students in more rural and remote parts of the state. So this draft, 2341, is a first stab at giving us a place to start the discussion for 2011. And Hannah has done a remarkable job of trying to pull all of these things together. The first thing you'll notice when you look at the bill or skim through it is that it's a little on the lengthy side. It's about exactly 111 pages long. But... That is very deceptive because one of the things that this draft does is break apart the virtual statute from the charter statute. And that's why the first 30 pages of the bill you'll see is all in bold and the rest of it is all in light text. So most of what you see in the bold in the very first part of the bill is not new law, it's not new language, it's current law related to virtual schools moved to its very own chapter. Embedded within that are some changes, and I would like to kind of walk you through those, if that's okay. So I thought I would first give you the broad strokes of what it is, and then we can go through section by section. Hannah is here to answer the logistics. After this meeting, it's a lot to digest. We can all continue meeting in smaller groups, and my hope is that some work can be done in smaller groups in January so that when we come back in February, the Education Committee is prepared to really start working on this and help us move on to other conversations. So essentially what this does is it breaks apart the charter statute from the virtual statute. And we create this entity that is called a virtual public school. And a virtual public school is a comprehensive instructional program offered in any grade from kindergarten through grade 12 that provides full-time online instruction, offers instruction to students under a contract with a school district board, and is certified as provided by Section 9 of this 2011 Act. So basically what we're creating are these statewide entities. And rather than chartering with a district, they would have a contracting district that they contract with to do some of these administrative functions. But they would not be charter schools. In order to operate, they would have to be certified by the State Board of Ed. That comes out of kind of that recommendation from the State Board that they are meeting all of the requirements. They have a proposal. Everything is going to be accessible. Everything that we've really laid out in statute already, that all of those things are met. It also says that the state board cannot impose restrictions or requirements that are more stringent than what it is that is put in the statute, whether that's geography or age or anything else. It has to be consistent with the statute. I forgot to say in the beginning of the introduction, because we're going to start getting to these things in just a moment, that for all of the people that are in the room that took the time to come today to talk about virtual learning, I know it's because you care very much about this issue. And if you care very much about this issue, there will be things in this draft that you like. And there will be things in this draft that are going to make you really angry. And depending on who you are, it will be different things. So I'm pretty sure that some of the things that will make one of you very happy will make the other person very angry. But I think there's a little bit here for everyone and hopefully provides the basis for a discussion. So with that as the introduction, the state board would then approve these entities, and it would allow the state board to approve up to three of these statewide things. Right now we have two. However, it also allows local school districts to do whatever they want as part of their arsenal of instruction to the students in their district. They can offer full-time, they can offer part-time, they don't have to go to the department to get approval for these things as long as they're meeting what's in the statute, unless through inter-district transfers they're enrolling more than 20% of that online program is coming from a different district. In that case, they just have to go to the department and they get kind of a stamp of approval, which is, if I'm Corvallis and I'm offering a full-time online program and saying, hey, send your kids over to me, I've got this third party that says to me over in Baker School District, yes, this district is making sure that everybody has access to diplomas and all of these other things. The other thing that would be different in this is that the 50% rule would go away. There would not be a 50% rule. Students could choose where to enroll in a full-time or part-time online option. It does not require approval from the sending school district unless from that sending school district, 3%, they hit a 3% mark, that 3% of that school district students are attending not a charter school, but attending one of these statewide virtual online schools. At that point, the school district can deny the student's enrollment in that. The parent has the ability to appeal that to the state board, but that district must also ensure that the student has access to a full-time online program. So again, I'm Corvallis, and Bethany comes in, and her parents do, and they submit their intent to enroll their kids in
Dolphin,
a statewide online school. And
that was safe.
What?
That was
like
safe.
Orca, Dolphin.
I was going to throw out a suggestion, but chose not
to. Do you have a third one?
Yeah, I do.
So Bethany in this model is that kid that triggers the 3%. At this point, the district can say, I'm sorry, 3% of our students are already out of the district. We can't let you go, so we're offering you this full-time. We have this full-time online option that is available to you. If they don't have that full-time online option, at that point, the district has a choice to make. They can choose to offer a full-time online option to that student from within their district. They can allow the student to go to that program that they're requesting to go to, or another program in a component district. And remember, you're getting this kind of stamp of approval, so everything is kind of equivalent to that is out there. And then again, the student is able to appeal that. One of the things that is important to remember in this is that there is not currently a district that is at 3% of their students attending a virtual online school. Okay, so the other thing that is different in this system is special education and English as a second language. Under our current process, and this is what we were talking about a few minutes before, Representative Huffman, under the current process, the students, if a student is not ELL or a student is not special education, they become basically the resident of wherever that school is that they attend. But if they are in special education, they remain a resident where they live, not where they're attending school. So that our current virtual schools are needing to invoice back to the local districts for special ed costs, or it's really bifurcated. One district is responsible for regular education, the other district is responsible for the special education. Sometimes that's working well, sometimes it is not working as well. The other problem is that means that for students in special education or ELL, their test scores, their AYP, is not reported with the school where they're attending. It is reported with the school where they physically live. So in this proposal, all students become basically residents of this district, this virtual online district. And with that virtual online district takes in all of the responsibilities that are related to that. That includes child fine, evaluation, their test scores will be reported there, the provision of all of the special education and related services. They can purchase services from a local school district or an ESD or however they want to do that, but they retain the responsibility for that. And I'll get to the funding in a minute. This also clarifies that in terms of the governance of the statewide, it clarifies that if there is a for-profit entity that is part of that provision of services, no representative of or employee of or board of directors member of or representative of that entity can be on the governing board of that school. That's a conflict of interest. It also clarifies that they cannot attend executive sessions of these meetings. It also clarifies that the contract has to allow for that independent board to be able to choose if that independent board decides to change vendor or change curriculum, and that the curriculum has to be updated as all the rest of the curriculum in the rest of the state. If the rules for updating standards apply to the Sweet Home School District, it's going to apply to Dolphin. Okay. And it also clarifies that if you are an employee of a school that is that kind of has this for-profit piece that is part of it, no employee of that school can proffer for sale or recommend supplemental services or products that might be sold by that entity. So that is the difference between saying, my child's teacher coming to me and saying, Nicole could really benefit from some math tutoring this summer, or saying, Nicole could really benefit from this specific program that you can get for only $129.95 that is available from K-12 or from Connections Academy. So again, it's not that the teacher can't say your student would benefit from tutoring or supplemental services, it's just they can't be advertising the product that is available to them. So probably the burning question that you all have, among all of the questions that I'm sure that you have about this, is how, if they're not charter schools, how are they funded? How does the money run? And if they have special ed, how does that run? So currently in the charter arrangement, the school, so let's just say Orca or Dolphin, or we'll just say Orca. So Orca gets a percentage. The district in which the student lives gets a percentage of that money as well. This would change that because they're no longer charters. The student would be funded like a student, like a resident. Basically, these become local education agencies, and they would directly receive 80% of the statewide average ADM. So it doesn't matter where you come from. If you come from a small district that has a higher ADM, you're not getting that higher ADM. If you come from a district like mine that has a lower ADM, you're not getting that ADM. It's just the straight across the board statewide ADM, 80% goes directly to this place. So it's point eight. From within that point eight, that entity, this district, that governing board of the school negotiates with that contracting district. So in the case of Orca, they would then go and negotiate with SIO for the services that SIO provides, and they would negotiate what up to 5% of ADM, what they would pay to a place like SIO. That remaining 20% that isn't there, that's not going anyplace. That just stays in the state school fund. For students in special education or a student that gets an additional weight, it's all based on that 0.8 factor. So if you are a special ed student, the virtual school Dolphin would get 1.6 ADM for that. There were concerns that were raised if you send the I'm summarizing lots of conversations with many dozens of people. If I'm going too fast, stop me.
Just so the 0.2% that remains in the state school fund and is just redistributed.
Correct. Across the whole state, including me. So part of that 0.8, that 0.8 is slightly enhanced for everybody because some of that is staying, you know, in the state school fund.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
And the board came up with the 0.8?
No. No, the point
where did
eight,
that come from?
The 0.8 came from we needed a number, and that's in the range of charter. My anticipation is that we will have lots of debate and discussion about what that number should be. What's the number?
Yes, Madam Chair. Could you just again back up and tell us the we that you're talking about? So, the state board, the task force charged the state board, or the bill that we passed charged the state board with coming up with recommendations, but this is not they. This came out of what?
This came from a conglomeration of the discussions at that task force, the recommendations of the state board, the alternative proposals that came out from other groups, all smashed into one initial proposal to have words on paper to start a discussion.
That's helpful.
Yeah.
This is the product of lots of discussions tried in an effort to try to put them on paper. I think what became difficult, there seemed to be general agreement around the idea of we need to separate these from the charter statute, from the virtual school statute. The big problem with that, when the state board wrestled with this, they didn't really get into the weeds of, oh my gosh, if they're not charter schools anymore, how do we pay for them? What's the mechanism? That left all sorts of questions that had never been dealt with. So we need something to start with. We had a bill drafting deadline of September 28th.
How did the number three come up?
Just it's again another arbitrary number.
Okay.
It's not less than what we have.
Yeah. Is there a possibility, whether it's, I don't want to offer Hannah's services or yours, but mm-hmm. that there is an overview of how this document came to be,
yes.
so that when different people come in to visit with us, we at least have an understanding what part of the conversations they...
Yes.
Yeah, because I'm not grounded in this at all at this point. It's
yes.
like, okay.
Yes.
I'm a little lost in the maze.
Yes. So let me finish quickly on the special ed piece and the money,
sure.
which is that some of the discussions, there was concern that if you have additional money flowing to a school for special ed or ELL, you want to make sure that those dollars are spent on special ed and ELL and not going to a profit margin or something else out of state. So there is a requirement that is part of the annual reporting of the school. They have to demonstrate how much they spent on special ed and ELL services for the students that are enrolled in that school. So there would be a tracking of, we sent you X number of dollars, you received X number of dollars in state school fund for special education. You have to demonstrate that you spent that number of dollars in special education services or ELL.
Because the regular school district doesn't have to do that.
The regular school district does not have to do that, but the regular school district, I mean, you kind of see where everything goes within that. There's not kind of a hidden curtain behind that.
On a school board, you don't see.
Mm-hmm.
But
anyway. Dr. Parker?
That was my question.
Okay. Yes, so no, that is not a requirement that's there. So then the next piece is, a district, we talked about a local school district or a consortium of districts could decide, and some do, to offer, so say Salem Kaiser Online, they offer their online program. That's part of their general operations of what they do in their school district. That would be, we're not going to change the way that the students in their district are funded based on that piece. Just as some districts have a K-6 and they have a K-8, and we don't change our state school fund based on whether they have this number of K-6s or K-8s, we're not going to change that formula. So the difference is that 0.8 is these statewide virtual programs, but that 0.8 does not apply to a district that's educating its own kid. It always stays in that place. Hannah, am I missing
Hannah Lai, Legislative Council, a very good, accurate summary, Chair. I did find two minor errors, if you'd like me to mention those.
Yes.
One is you were talking about the separation of the different boards and employees, and you had said that you cannot have a for-profit entity on the board. We just have third-party entities,
okay.
So that would be a little bit broader.
Okay.
The second is more terminology instead of concept. You're talking about we'd be looking at the statewide ADM. It would be the ADMW. So when we're looking at the statewide average for the purposes of weighted, but we're looking at the ADM for the school itself. So we're looking at how many kids are at the school, but when we're trying to figure out how much weights we're going to contribute to them, we're going to be looking at the statewide. So just little minor tweaks. And to help you kind of work through this, a lot of this bold section is based on ORS Chapter 338, which is the public charter schools. Just some of the language obviously wouldn't apply, like having the state board become a sponsor obviously was taken out. Some of that appeals process was taken out just because it didn't apply here. But a lot of these statutes are the same. There's a list of statutes that the virtual school must follow. Those are the same as what are in the public charter schools. So this really isn't as new as it seems. It's not as intimidating as it seems. It's really heavily based on ORS Chapter 338. And I'll let you continue from there.
Okay, Representative Springer had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to confirm what I think I'm hearing and what I understand, so if you're in a school district that provides online services,
mm-hmm.
so that student would receive the regular 100% ADMW, even though they're an online student within that school district?
Correct. Just as an AP student receives the same weight in that district as another. I think the philosophy behind that was, as a district puts together a whole component list of services, they don't kind of budget to the head because there's a whole diverse variety of different types of services that you're offering. The question that the policy question that the legislature will have to wrestle with is what is that appropriate number? But you're looking at a statewide school that's built upon a very specific educational model, and we will know or determine what the appropriate cost is for the reimbursement of that model. It's not that there are going to be less and more cost-effective or costly models within that. I mean, a virtual school is focused on virtual learning. A school district, you know, high school is more expensive than elementary school, and it all kind of morphs within that district.
No, I'm sure.
Representative Thatcher.
Forgive me for this question, but I'm hearing often that there was broad agreement, that we needed to separate the virtual school statute from the regular charter school statute, and I'm just wondering why. Why? Well, there's lots of reasons, or just I'm just wondering if you could highlight a couple main ones.
I think many different people probably had different motives for that, and I would invite anyone else that was sitting on the task force.
But I remember in committee, this came up in conversation in committee, and it was obvious that the conversations were getting real mixed and confused because of the statutory language and what was a virtual school, was a charter school, and then the virtual charter school. And so, I didn't look at that necessarily as like a political issue, although it gets very political once you get into the weeds of it, but from just a pragmatic standpoint, even at that time, it seemed like it was like, yeah, you probably need to look at it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the outcome is.
And I think that's one of the pieces that is kind of, I wish that the state board had the opportunity to delve into this more deeply. If you think about the timelines that we had, the state board delivered its report on September 1st. There wasn't a lot of detail in that in terms of where do you go after you separate it out. that came from there as well. But for all of these things, once you put them on paper and try to figure out how it works, it raises a whole series of other questions. I think that the separating the statutes is going to raise a series of questions. How do you fund them raises a series of questions. How do you do the enrollment raises a series of questions. I think that we heard before a lot of interest in the special ed residency. I will be curious as we move further down this conversation if kind of how the benefits and obligations weigh against each other and where people land on their preferences on those as we get into further discussions about these. Representative Huffman.
I was a member of the Online Learning Task Force, and I remember in one of our first meetings, if not the first meeting, we had a breakout session in individual groups, and I was the one in our group that immediately suggested that we start looking at a separate governance model for the virtual learning, because the questions we were trying to answer to get the ball rolling on the task force work was very difficult when you were trying to look at virtual learning within the context of the charter governance model. And I don't remember the exact question that came up that all of a sudden I'm going, whoa, this is going to be really tough. So that's the context that this that part came out of.
Thank you.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, you know, I think that, you know, one of the things that sparked the whole conversation was the fact that our treatment of online learning, you know, is kind of a Frankenstein system that we have in this school, in this state, where online learning got grafted onto the charter school, and it got eaten up by conversations around charter schools, as opposed to conversations really about distance learning and, you know, that modality. And I think that was one of the first things that the task force recognized, was that, you know, we're, you know, in a sense just dealing with, you know, the tail is wagging the dog here, in that, you know, this little piece of the way that online learning should happen in this state is being, you know, dominated by discussion of what are essentially charter school issues. So if we could split the two and really focus on how can we get quality online education to more kids in this state and not have to refight the charter school wars, as it were, or to keep those conversations separate, I think that's a lot of sort of the, you know, the in the trenches sort of motivation for this. You know, the unfortunate thing is, just following up on the chair's comment, the state board really didn't have enough time, I think, to really have that substantial conversation about what distance education should be like in this state, nor did the task force that was created. And so, you know, the chair is now faced with she's bravely faced with the task of trying to cobble something together, which, you know, I fear is, again, going to be a kind of Frankenstein. But, you know, I understand the need that we have to move forward with this. I think there are going to continue to be a lot of questions.
And I have absolutely no doubt that there will be a lot of questions. I anticipate a lot of loud email in my email box tonight. And I think I would just ask everyone here and everyone in the room we have to deal with this issue. We have to come to some conclusions on this issue. And we've had the task force, we've had the state board, we have bounced legislators. More importantly, we've bounced families and kids around about this issue for a really long time. And my hope is that this is a session where we can put some sort of a wrapper on this thing for a while, where it's in a place that gives some degree of certainty about what the state's policy is on online learning, where we want to go with it, and that it doesn't continue to kind of dominate the education discussions that we have. To me, if I, you know, coming away from the summit yesterday, looking at all of the issues that people at this dais and in this room and across the building, across the state, have raised about public education, there are a lot of things that we need to be tackling right now. And there's a huge opportunity cost for every hour that we continue to spend on this. And if I think about this issue, we have spent more hours on this issue than any other issue that we have worked on in this committee, including the School for the Blind, which seems nearly impossible. And there's a point at which we have to come to a conclusion. It's not going to be a conclusion that makes everybody happy, because there is a huge diversity of opinions on this issue. And that was something that Senator Devlin and I really struggled with on that online task force, is how do you come up with something that can get 31 and 16 in these two chambers? Because it's the type of issue, you move a little bit this way and you pick up a couple people, but you lose a couple others. People have very strong feelings about these issues, and it actually doesn't always follow along partisan lines either. And we have a great kind of structure this session to really test our mettle and seeing how we can come to a conclusion on this. My hope is that we do come to a conclusion, and it's something that serves kids well, that's fiscally responsible, that improves opportunities for kids. I think one of the things that's in here is really trying to make sure there aren't barriers to districts, and this was something Representative Huffman raised time and again. How do we make sure that local school districts have the ability to enhance and add and be able to bring part-time online and full-time online into their toolbox of what they're offering to their kids? And this does take away a lot of those barriers, or at least it tries to.
Just one question: as we proceed in session on this, are we going to give this enough hearing time to really kind of work through some of this stuff? It's not going to be relegated to two hearings and no changes and.
No, I mean, this is different than the interim. That would be obviously we're in a time of transition. It would be my guidance to whoever it is that chairs this committee next, or whoever those people are that chair this committee in the next session, that it is something that's on the agenda in the beginning. I am committed to continuing to work on this. I hope to work with all of you and the people in this room in the month of January, and that is part of the point of having something now in writing that is a starting point of a discussion that we can pre-session file, so that when we come in February, the Education Committee can start having those conversations, both formally in the committee and doing some of that offline work that needs to take place. And I would really invite, none of us know where we're all going to be sitting a month from now in this room or any other, but you all have spent a lot of time with this issue, and whether you serve on an Education Committee or not, or are just writing letters to us from Pennsylvania. Where are you going?
Emails.
You all know a lot, so I hope that you will contribute that institutional knowledge, and feel free to just start tearing this thing apart and making different suggestions. The goal is to get it right, and the best chance to get there is to have something in writing to actually concrete talk about. And if you're a paper reader, again, I would suggest you print out the first, if you're looking for something before you go to bed tonight, the first 30 pages kind of get you to the meat of it. You can save the paper on 970, read that part on the paper.
Sure.
That's what they all say.
Just don't read page 76, line 22. Any further?
Good luck. No, I'm sincere. I mean, I think you have an opportunity to not be driven by some, by the outside forces that push the agenda, because you are correct. This issue has to be dealt with. But I also, on the flip side of that, is that the evolution of time and the technology and the way the fiscal crisis, everything is conspiring together to allow this conversation to come to a head in this session, and fortunately or unfortunately, split is going to really drive some compromise. And so I think, yeah, good luck, because you have an opportunity to do something.
So this is a strange moment in this committee where all is quiet. And our next piece does not start until 3 o'clock, so we could actually take a brief recess if people would like that. All right, let's recess till 3 o'clock.
Great, thanks. The House Committee on Education will return to order. So it is, it's still Tuesday, December 14th. I'd like to welcome Representative Frederick, who's visiting us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Our next agenda item, which is model policy regarding religious dress. And I would invite up Kate Newhall and Cindy Hunt, who are going to give us a brief overview of the hot off the presses recently released model policy for school districts for the religious dress in schools issue that you probably all recall is another one of those non-controversial issues that we have had the opportunity to work together discussing.
Me too.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kate Newhall. I'm the Legislative Director at the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I thank you for the opportunity to be here today to provide an update on the model policy that we have been working on with a work group and give you a report on that. Just a little bit of background quickly. As you know, House Bill 3686 repealed Oregon's prohibition on teachers wearing religious dress in the classroom, which will be effective July 1st, 2011. Passage of this legislation was a very important issue for both the state school superintendent and the state labor commissioner, who felt strongly about extending workplace religious freedoms to Oregon's teachers who have been precluded from wearing religious clothing at work for almost 90 years. After the passage of House Bill 3686, and well before the bill's effective date, the superintendent and the labor commissioner convened a work group of interested parties to develop a model policy for school districts to use in determining whether a particular item of clothing may disrupt the learning environment or to create the impression that a school is endorsing a particular religious affiliation. The work group was comprised of representatives from the Department of Education, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, the State Legislature, the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland, the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon, the Sikh American Legal Defense Fund, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, the Oregon School Employees Association, the Oregon Family Council, the Northwest Religious Liberty Association, the Oregon School Boards Association, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and the Oregon Education Association. In addition, Professor Steve Green and Saba Ahmed also participated as interested parties and brought a wealth of expertise to our workgroup discussions. I should also note that the ACLU, who opposed 3686, while they did participate in the work group and lent their expertise and knowledge to the development of this policy, did not formally endorse it. So after me, Cindy Hunt from the Department of Education will provide an overview of the policy, but the remainder of my testimony will include some of the efforts to disseminate this policy to school districts, school boards, educators, school employees, parents, and the general public. The reason that I'm going to focus on this is because one of the things that the work group recognized was the importance of actually reaching out to school districts and making sure that they were aware of the model policy, understood it, and encouraging them to adopt it. So after the work group finalized this policy, press releases regarding its creation were issued by both the Department of Education and by BOLI, and they generated a number of media stories about the policy and its availability to school districts. In addition, the policy is now prominently posted on the websites of the Department of Education, BOLI, and the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, who are all encouraging its adoption. And the Oregon School Boards Association is also disseminating the policy to its membership. In coming weeks, since it is very much hot off the presses, the Oregon Department of Education will spotlight the policy in its January's Superintendent's Pipeline, which is a newsletter that's sent monthly to all superintendents and school districts. In addition, BOLI's Technical Assistance for Employers program is in the process of writing frequently asked questions for school district employers to use in helping understand how to apply the policy and the law to accommodate religious clothing in an educational environment. BOLI will also do an overview of the policy and law in one of our upcoming Technical Assistance for Employers news columns, and this is a news column that the Bureau does weekly that's carried in a number of newspapers around the state. Additionally, I know individual work group participants will be disseminating the policy through their own advocacy networks and working with districts and school boards to encourage its adoption, as well as tracking what districts have actually adopted it. With that, I will conclude my testimony, and thank you for the opportunity to provide this update. We'll be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Okay,
Okay, Cindy Hunt, Department of Education. What House Bill 3686 started last session was the balancing of two competing constitutional issues. The freedom of religion with also the obligation that school districts have to maintain a environment that's neutral, but yet also inviting to all religions. Not an easy task by any means. And I know that the policy was also developed because of some of the concerns expressed in this committee the last time I think we testified on this bill, was that the school districts would have this law and not have support for the complex legal issues that's raised. And so the model policy is an attempt to illuminate, give the district some guidance in this area as they attempt to apply it to individual situations. So as we were doing this, we incorporated existing case law. We had a couple of constitutional law scholars on this group, and also tried to strike that balance between individual freedoms and yet the obligation of the district. So in doing that, a couple of things we talked about is, first of all, what is religious clothing? So we defined it in the policy as head coverings, jewelry, emblems, and other types of religious dress so that everyone could be at least somewhat clear about what we were talking about. And then we also emphasized around the district's obligations under Oregon and federal law to maintain religious neutrality, but also be welcoming to people of all faiths. And then in giving guidance to the school districts in applying this, we asked them to look at the intent of the employee in wearing the religious clothing, but also the perception of the students, parents, and community members when they were viewing the clothing, and gave them some factors to consider as they were weighing these two interests. So the things that are listed in the policy are things like the size and visibility of the religious clothing. A lot of this clothing is not visible to anyone. It's, for example, a necklace that's behind, you know, a shirt or something like that, or maybe it's something on an arm. So that was one of the factors. The inclusion of any writing or symbols on the clothing that communicates a direct message, we felt that that was going more in the direction of proselytizing as opposed to really just wearing the clothing. Any accompanying verbal statements or declarations of a religious nature that go beyond the limited explanation of the religious significance or obligation associated with wearing the clothing. The number of employees, again, we're balancing the endorsement of religion versus religious freedom. So if we have a lot of employees wearing a specific religious dress, that tips in the endorsement kind of category. So that was one of the issues that we raised in the policy. And then also to take into consideration the reasonableness of the perception based on the age, background, sophistication of whether the student, the community members, the parents, because what a kindergartner perceives or is able to understand is much different than a high school student. And that's also right out of the case law. We also ask school districts to consider very specifically whether the wearing of the religious clothing disrupts the educational process or serves to harass or intimidate, coerce, interfere with the rights of students, parents, and school employees in the district. So as Kate said, we have distributed the policy broadly. We have not required districts to adopt this. This is just guidance. And with that, we'll answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Are there questions? They're everywhere. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cindy, I'm sorry, your closing comment there, you have not adopted, but this is just guidance. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, that's true. We have not, the state board, for example, has not adopted a rule that says school districts must adopt this policy. But we have distributed it broadly as one option for them to incorporate as a policy or in their employee guidebooks, for example, or to use as guidance when they're looking at these issues.
Follow up?
So, thank you. Are we leaving school districts hanging out there somewhat without a clear
directive?
Not mandate. I was trying to avoid clear directive.
Expectation.
Like the bully bill, you know, there was a directive that a school district must have a bully policy in place. And
Chair Gels, Representative Huffman, a couple of reasons that the State Board of Ed did not direct them to adopt policy. The bill was phrased in terms of employer-employee relationship, so that's more in Bowley's area. And we have existing statutes, rules, etc., that school districts have to have anti-discrimination policies in place around religion, for example. They have to have complaint mechanisms if they do get a complaint around, you know, religious discrimination or any other form of discrimination. So those were already in existence. And we didn't feel that because of this we needed to tweak those or anything like that.
And Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I think from an employment law perspective, the Bureau of Labor Industries would advise employers that they would, I think, be prudent to adopt some sort of policy so that they were applying their policies consistently among all teachers. And I think even though we have not mandated it, I think the intent was to provide guidance to those school districts, give them something that they could adopt, they could modify. If a school district were calling us as an employer, we would strongly suggest that they and advise that they have some sort of policy and would encourage the adoption of this policy, I think, as the Department of Education has.
Last follow-up. Quickly. Either one, Cindy or Kate, have either one of you met with, like, at a OSBA conference or something to try to educate and inform school boards as to what the expectations might be?
Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, this policy was put together 2 weeks ago. I think it was 2 weeks ago, so it's very new. So we have not gone to a conference yet. That's one of the things that may be anticipated in the future. Certainly one of the things that the work group talked about, various means of educating, and some of the work group members volunteered to sit on panels and that kind of thing at conferences. So that is something that's anticipated.
Thank you.
Representative Comp.
Thanks, Chair Gelser. I'm on the same path as my colleague, Representative Huffman. If you could remind us of the actual language within the bill that we passed, it would be very helpful, because it is my understanding, as somebody that voted on this bill, that school districts would create policy, not may. It was more of a shall than a may.
Chair Gelser, Representative Comp, I have the House bill here in front of me, and it does not specifically direct school districts to adopt a policy. We think it's best practice for them to do so, or at least incorporate this in their employee handbooks, but does not specifically direct them to do that.
Okay, and follow-up. Was there a timeline designated within the bill to implement?
Yes, Representative Comp. The whole bill becomes effective July 1st, 2011. So these districts have 6 months, roughly, 6.5 months from today to do this.
Okay, that's how you count the calendar? It's six additional. You said was to be implemented by June of 11?
Okay. July 1st, 2011.
Okay.
So it's about 6.5 months from
now.
Okay.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Maurer?
So is it expected that OSBA will create a model policy for... Because, I'm sorry, Morgan, I really don't...
I knew it could get you back.
On a school board, you look... What you want? You don't want to recreate the wheel, so you turn to somebody, and the OSBA was really good at creating model policies, and so the question is this something that you would do? Because I know school districts are going to look for something.
Chair Gelser and Representative Maurer, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Oregon School Boards Association. The short answer to your question is we were one of the 20 or so odd participants in the group, and we promised the group to share the policy. As a matter of fact, it just went out today, I believe, to most of our membership. We have information about the policy posted on our website with a link to the release from the superintendent and the labor commissioner. And at this point, our folks are you know, going to field. We've started to get some questions from the field about that, and I think it's sort of yet to be determined if we're going to take any further action for our members. It's going to basically depend on, you know, what our members say they need. And as Ms. Newhall and Ms. Hunt mentioned, the policy was designed to give school districts maximum flexibility that they could, you know, adopt that, you know, sort of en blanc if they wanted to, if they felt like they needed a few tweaks for their district. But our folks have said, you know, basically the message is this is good guidance from the labor commissioner and the superintendent of Ohio Construction, and you should really read this.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Kelso. But what it really means is that if you don't do this, you become vulnerable.
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, I'm not an attorney and certainly not a constitutional scholar, but in my layperson's opinion, there is, from sitting in on the multitude of sort of work groups and committees where we had constitutional experts and attorneys talking about this, the one thing that I took away that I felt was very clear was that there's plenty of case law and protections within the U.S. and the Oregon Constitution that if there are any ever questions about this, and I think the concern I'm hearing from the panel is that a district, a principal, a superintendent, an ESD might mishandle an instance and perhaps either overzealously tell the employee that they cannot wear the garment or underzealously, you know, prohibit a T-shirt with sloganeering or something like that. In my opinion, as a layperson, if it goes to the court, the case law is clear that what is and what is not acceptable is religious garb. So I don't personally think it's a problem. I'm sure there are some attorneys and constitutional law scholars that might take issue with that, but in my opinion, listening to everyone talk about it, the case law is clear. Whether a district has a policy, this exact policy, a slightly different policy, the legal. I guess I don't know what the correct word is, but the courts have already ruled on this pretty clearly, and the constitutions are clear on this issue.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up?
I had a follow-up. Well, just a comment, if I may. I would think that the citation of ORS 327.109 would be something that districts would really respond to, and I guess it's an illumination of the issues that are faced by schools when it comes to religion.
Well, and I think one thing I would add, Representative Van Orman, is that I think I can speak broadly for the education groups that participated, is we appreciated that both the superintendent and the labor commissioner, we hear a lot of talk about mandates and you know, from both the state and federal governments, and this was, I think, a good opportunity of collaboration where our elected officials recognized the ability of our local school boards and locally elected officials to work these issues out by giving us good guidance and trusting that we can come to proper solutions. So we appreciate that.
Representative Frederick.
Hello there. I have some concerns, and I'd like for you to, if you'd speak to them. I'm not a constitutional lawyer either, but I do, and I'm not attempting to play one by any means, but I would like, I'm concerned about it's on-the-ground situations. I have, in my history, have seen situations where there has been hesitancy to deal with the past rules regarding religious garb or religious discrimination because of concerns about dealing with a particular employee or dealing with a group of families or whatever. What kind of support is the state going to be able to give to these districts, these principals, on a day-to-day basis if they run up against the things that I ran up against, T-shirts that were, in fact, emblazoned with certain things, or one young woman who decided that she needed to make sure everyone knew she was Wiccan and was teaching as well. What kind of support are you giving superintendents, principals, school districts to deal with legal cases regarding this?
Chair Gelser, Representative Frederick, in answer to your question, I think I have a two-part answer. The policy addresses some of what you've raised around, you know, the language kind of stuff that was one of the factors that was in the policy. So the first answer that we have is that going down that policy, it gives those individuals, administrators, school districts, principals, some guidance as to, you know, what kind of issues to consider when they're faced with the employee who wants to wear the particular garb. So that's the first part. The second part, speaking for the Department of Education, Education, we frequently get phone calls from the field around, you know, here's the situation, what do you think about this, where can I go for guidance, you know, what's kind of the law in this area. We answer those kinds of questions all the time. We definitely get questions in the civil rights area around, you know, discrimination and various things. Often we refer those calls to our friends over here at Boley when they involve an employee, to be honest. And I'm going to turn it over to my two colleagues here because I believe both of their organizations also give support to districts of various kinds.
Madam Chair, Representative Frederick, at the Bureau of Labor and Industry, we also, from an employment relationship perspective, have our Technical Assistance for Employers program that runs a hotline. So if employers, and not just specifically school districts, but say if any employer had questions about employment law or specifically about being an employer as a school district, called in and had questions with a specific case and kind of wanted to run through it, our technical assistance folks would be there to go through that specific case and help them navigate sort of what a best solution in that specific instance might be. And that hotline is 5 days a week, so, you know, 8 hours a day.
If I might follow up. I understand the hotline availability. My concern is that the cost of a case for a school district might be prohibitive and they might back off on attempting to deal with a particular case. I've frankly seen that happen. So I am curious about whether there is any indication on that kind of support for a district to be able to handle something if a legal case is going to hit into a very limited budget that school districts have right now.
Mm-hmm. Representative Frederick, Chair Gelser, you know, as far as the cost issue, one of our hopes is that if the districts do adopt this policy, that it would mitigate their vulnerability to lawsuits. Obviously, I can't sit here and promise that there will be none or anything like that. I can also share with you that we do get complaints based on religious discrimination at the department. We're charged with investigating those at various levels. The complaint generally, when it first comes, the district generally does not have their attorney involved. So it's almost at a lower level. It's more fact-finding. It's not until it reaches a higher level when they're going to court, that kind of thing, that they start to get their legal team involved. So in that way, some of the costs are mitigated. But, you know, this issue, before the bill was passed, after the bill was passed, before the policy was created, after the policy has been created, these issues existed, they continue to exist, they will exist for the next 100 years, 200 years. So a lot of that we can't necessarily mitigate just through a policy. These issues have to be resolved somewhat at the local level by working through the guidance, working through them on an individual basis.
One brief one. If a family or a student is concerned about proselytizing that is taking place, where do they go and how quickly is that going to be handled?
Chair Gelser, Representative Frederick, they have a number of options, actually. The first option is to complain to their local district. They can complain, for example, to their local school principal, and it may be addressed within a matter of hours, if not days, you know, very quickly. All of the districts will have a complaint process that they've adopted. If they don't get resolution there, they generally have a superintendent or a local school board that they can go to. If they don't, there's also a couple of statutes that they can come directly to the superintendent of public instruction with their complaint, and that's any person who believes that a district's endorsing religion or entangled in religion. A legislator could come with a complaint, member of the public, anyone. We just received an anonymous complaint under that statute. So in that case, that doesn't cost the family or the complainant. It may cost them time in that we follow up with them and talk to them and interview them and that kind of thing. They also have an ability, if they're an employee, I know Boley has a complaint mechanism, which is also available to them. There's other remedies out there. They can file a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights. That's also free. There's also various court options, you know, in both state and federal court that would be more costly, and that they'd likely have to hire an attorney to do that.
It's just one last comment, if you don't mind. For most of the most of the people who might be interested in filing that complaint, they do not have the knowledge of where to go. I would encourage you, if possible, to place within any policy that kind of information, so that the general public, that a student, a parent, another teacher, other employee, might be able to know where to go for real, for that kind of real information.
I appreciate that. The complaint process that most districts have adopted specifically has in it that, you know, if your complaint is not resolved here, you can go to the superintendent of public instruction. And then on our website, for example, in the civil rights area, we have links and phone numbers and that kind of thing. So there's a couple of mechanisms for them getting that information.
I'm suggesting that within the news release, you make sure that that's part of the news release as well. Thank you.
And we're a little over time. Are there any final questions, comments?
I have one, Madam Chair. Kind of following up on the line that Representative Frederick was taking us down, you know, I think this policy is a great start, and it has helped me to hear you sort of flesh it out with some examples. And I'm wondering if that's not something that, say, the OSBA, the department could do, is provide some sort of scenarios or some examples of, what might be considered acceptable language on a T-shirt and what might start to raise problems. I mean, I realize there may be some legal issues with your being too specific, but I think that, you know, scenario kind of explanations are really useful for a real-world kind of understanding of a policy.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, but he does raise a question. The issue is not about the apparel. The issue is about the behavior. Is it not? So in other words, if I wear a shirt, that's not the issue. It's what I do to support what the shirt implies.
Representative Van Orman, or Chair Gelser, it's both. There's examples from other states of, generally students is the examples that I'm thinking of, where the message on the shirt could be seen as harassing or bullying another student. So it's not just, you know, that's an issue of dress, but it's also an issue somewhat of behavior in that they're having a message on their shirt, so it's both.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. We will conclude. Morgan, thank you for coming. So, Morgan, last session you helped us understand the concept of the sponge. Is there one at OSBA or in the local districts?
I bequeath that to my friends.
All right. All right.
No sponge is ever too full for the OSBA. All
right. So we are going to move on to a discussion about the use of spell check, and we have Superintendent Susan Castillo here to be part of that discussion with us. Please join us. And are you going to start with a presentation and then move on to questions?
If I could, Madam Chair.
All right. Sounds good to me.
That's what I was planning, if that's okay with you. Yep. For the record, Susan Castillo, the State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the State of Oregon. And I'm joined by Tony Alpert, who's the Director of Assessment and Accountability at the Department. And we're going to, at one point in this presentation, what we'd like to do is take you to and give you an example of how the spell check works in our writing test today, so that you get a real live example of how it works. Let me just, I know you have testimony, written testimony from me, so I'm not going to go through that exactly and read the whole thing, but I do want to highlight just some important points that I want to make as we're talking about online writing tests for our students.
Can I interrupt for a minute? Yes. Cheyenne has just indicated that is available on the shared drive.
What is the
Would it be possible just to get the testimony, and would that be helpful to people to have it, or can you access the...
Okay.
Okay.
We will eventually get it.
Because not everybody has their laptops. Sorry. Thank you.
All right, please proceed. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. So Oregon students are required to be tested once per year on their writing abilities in the 4th, 7th, and now 11th grades. Students can take an online writing test or a traditional paper and a pencil writing test. The decision to use online testing for writing is a local one and is dependent upon several factors, including the computer availability at each school. So it is a local decision. In last school year, 11,000 high school students took the online writing test, while 38,000 took the paper and pencil. Grade 7 was still in a pilot and was open to approximately 4,500 students. Online writing tests are not currently an option for our fourth grade students. Oregon students at all levels have always had the option of spell-checking individual words through the use of a dictionary or the more modern version of a dictionary, a handheld electronic spell checker. Starting this school year, students will have the option of using spell check when taking the state writing test online, and this applies only to middle and high school students, not elementary school students. Spelling is still a standalone part of the fourth grade curriculum, and by middle school and high school, it is not, although our schools still do work with their students on spelling. Of course, it's an important skill. Students taking the online version of the writing test will have access to a spell check feature. However, this is not an autocorrect feature. Students do have to turn it on, and they have to know how to use it. The spell check feature highlights words that are potentially incorrect, and students will then be responsible for selecting the correct word from a choice of words in the same way one uses a dictionary. The spell check is only for spelling and will not highlight grammatical errors. So we'd like to take you to an example of what we're talking about here.
So these are some screenshots from our practice test, which is available for all students to use pretty much throughout the year. And this is we'll show you an example of how that practice test looks for writing. So when students enter the system, you can see that they have access to a variety of assessment options. Chose grade 7. These are a variety of practice tests that they can choose from. When students are enter the system after they've chosen writing, they get some examples of prompts, and those are the topics to which students write or about which students write. And this is the exact same process that a student would use during the actual operational assessment. Once the student has chosen a topic, the student now can begin writing. And is that legible? Let me see if I can make a little bit bigger. A little bit bigger, if that helps.
Could I have a question while we're...
Of course.
Thinking about this, one of the questions I have is that
my assumption is that there is a presumption that the children can type, and not all children have typing at that age. Maybe they do. And the reason I bring up the question, because my issue with spell check is not because I can't spell, is that I apparently can't type anymore. So that I have errors based on my typing as opposed to my ability to spell. So I thought it's interesting at that age that they might be able to do the manual process of typing in the story.
Absolutely. Madam Chair and Representative Van Orman, that is one of the skill sets for our students, is being comfortable with using word processing, using online tools for writing, being comfortable with the keyboard, and knowing the shortcuts, knowing what tools are available to them as they use word processing, and not letting the challenge of the keyboarding challenges or keyboarding skills get in the way of us being able to judge their abilities to their writing abilities in terms of being able to express themselves and demonstrate their writing skills and expressing complete thoughts and so that is one of the other components of what we're doing with the writing test, is not letting the technology get in the way of being able to really see what's happening with the development of their writing.
Okay. Thank you.
And could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yeah, for the record, Tony Elbert, Director of Assessment.
Thank you.
Sorry. Apologize for that. So on the screen now, you can see that we simulated a poorly constructed sentence with a few errors. There's a word that sounds the same but is spelled differently. It's a homonym, and it's T-H-E-I-R. It should be there. So there are questions about how spell check works, and then inserted some inappropriate punctuation, and also capitalized the last word, idea, to show that what spell check will and will not identify. So once the student has typed a series of words, it's hard to show and make it big enough for everyone to see. It's a little bit hard to see this, but
maybe you could read just what the pull down says.
Yeah. So you'll notice that the only word that it did in fact highlight was WRKS, and then it gave a list of options. So it's identifying possible appropriate spellings as works, inks, arcs, walks, wrecks, wrecks in a different a homonym, racks, and rest. And so the student then has to know what the correct word is and the correct spelling and choose that. It did not identify that the spelling of there, T-H-E-R, was incorrect, that in fact it should have been T-H-E-R-E. Similarly, it did not identify the other conventions errors, like the exclamation mark that followed a comma. And it didn't suggest that the full caps of idea was inappropriate as well. So it really is focusing on a very small component of conventions, giving the students some additional tools and resources to identify what the potential misspellings are, and then requiring that the student use their knowledge and skills about spelling to pick the most appropriate word, consistent with how we would expect students might learn to use the technology later in life, to the extent that they understand that they do have to have spelling skills in order to use that tool effectively, then they are less likely to make that mistake later when it's probably even a little bit more important.
And just a couple more points is that we did
make this change after being in consultation with the field for about a year. We did meet with stakeholders and English language arts experts from around the state and decided that we would move this direction. The national test, the National Assessment of Education Progress, which is known as really the nation's report card and is cited very often as the federal government is looking at how states are measuring up from state to state, how we look at how we measure up internationally. The NAEP is often referred to as the measuring stick for now. And NAEP also uses spell check, but not for grammar check, as we're using it in the state of Oregon. And as we're moving forward with working on the next generation of assessments in our country and bringing states together to work on that and using the technology and the tools of technology to improve what we do with assessments and have it be more supportive of teaching and learning, I believe that spell check is probably will be a component or one of the tools that will be available for our students as we move in that direction. And it's a very exciting time right now as advancements in technology are really allowing us to do more exciting work with our students on assessing their skills. And Madam Chair and members of the committee, we're ready for your questions.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The youngest grade level that uses this, did I hear, was seventh grade?
Yes, Representative Huffman.
Okay. That it makes a little more sense taking that into consideration. Otherwise, you know, if you don't consider that, it sounds like you're giving a fourth grade spelling test open book. And you know, it's kind of hard to screw up when you have an open book spelling test. I still struggle with the concept of using the spell check, I'll be honest with you, but I guess when you start at seventh grade, it's not quite as bad.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here and for this presentation, helping us understand this. I probably have a couple, three questions, but I'll start with, are there a lot of students choosing the pencil and paper version over the electronic version?
I believe, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Springer, I believe it's the school's decision on whether or not they'll use online testing, or is it a student decision on whether they're going to use online or a paper pencil?
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, I would think that it's most likely a school decision and that...
And access to technology at the school.
Yeah.
Follow-up? I think if I understood, I had conversations with folks in three of my districts yesterday. I think students do have an option also, I think. That said, does this create a disadvantage for those pencil and paper kids opposed to the electronic, the spell check version or taking it online? The reason I ask that is when we're taking a test and we don't have something, the electronic version is highlighting what's misspelled. Paper version is not telling you that. You have no feedback. So I'm asking about that disadvantage. And if we go with the philosophy that schools are making this decision, we've got some skewed information there.
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, that's it's a critical question around comparability, and we struggled with that, and we continue to struggle with it. At some point, there has to be either a complete tip over into an online assessment, or we have to have some kind of transition process. And that transition process either has to be forced or it has to be voluntary. And at this point, we want to make that technology available. We want to make those options and opportunities available for those that can use it. We want to encourage people to move to that online system because we think that will help students better prepare for their next steps in life. But we're not quite prepared
to force all school districts to use that because they may not have the capacity for whatever reason. And so what we've committed to is continue to look at comparability issues to make resources available as available and appropriate, and by at least allowing the electronic handheld spell checker where kids can type in words, that does make that option a little bit more feasible. In addition, students can use word processors, continue to use word processors, so even if they don't have a full suite of labs available, if there's a computer in the back of the room and they want to type in a word and use the spell check feature of that for specific sentences or specific words, that option is available. So we're trying to be innovative and manage the transition as best as possible while still maintaining feasibility for schools.
Another follow-up?
Another question, please. How many other states are doing this?
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, I don't have that count right now. I know of at least two states that are using online assessment. I don't know whether or not they're allowing spell check. The National Assessment of Educational Progress just recently incorporated spell check into their online writing assessment, computer-based writing assessment. So I expect that many states will follow suit soon thereafter. But I don't have those counts for you right now.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Maurer?
Does the SAT allow spell check?
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, I don't know that.
It doesn't allow spell check. I mean, this goes back to, I mean, the implementation is one piece of it, and that's a struggle, but that's a different issue. But philosophically, I just have a problem with spell check.
Hmm.
I mean, it's just an educational philosophy. When we're doing a speed test for addition and subtraction, a calculator isn't of much value if you're having to punch in numbers. And if you're having to count on fingers in a speed test, you're probably not going to do very well. And in this test, if you can't spell, we have some issues. Mm-hmm. And going from one technology, another piece of it is the technology itself. This spell check doesn't operate the same as Microsoft Word. And so if most kids are going to be using Word or some program similar. And so they're going to get used to the way Word, highlights words and helps you with grammar. Now they get to hear, now they got to figure out a new way, a different way. And so that's an issue. But just the philosophical use of spell check, I don't think, helps our kids. And that's just a position I hold. Thank you.
Representative Hooker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I share some of my colleagues' concerns here. I want to go at a little different aspect of this, though. Who funded the development of this software or the procurement of it?
Chair Gelser, Representative Harker, we have a contract with American Institutes for Research to provide online assessment. So they had the basic infrastructure is incorporated into our suite of test administration, and then there were some incremental costs required for online writing assessment. We actually had to remove the spelling component in our first year. Because it was technology that was afforded, we did not have to pay for the spell check particularly. It was already incorporated into their system, so we just had to let that functionality be added back in.
Thank you. Provided to the state as software as a service maintained by this organization. Works with multiple browsers. Works on non-Windows machines.
Chair Gelser and Representative Harker, yes, it is I believe, I'm not a procurement expert, but I believe it's a service provider contract. I don't know the exact term of it, but we do offer access
through a Mozilla browser that's provided by American Institutes for Research. It works on Linux, several versions of Windows, and several versions of the Macintosh operating system. And our requirement as part of the open request for proposals that American Institutes for Research bid on and won was that they had to create a system that worked with the technology that was available in the school districts. And so that's why we offer a pretty dramatic suite of browsers to make sure that schools that will adapt to the schools rather than making the schools adapt to our system.
Okay, good. Thank you.
We've got three more in the queue, and we are over time and have our next presenter stacking up. So, Representative Van Orman?
I'll try to be brief. Thank you, Chair Gelser. In terms of assessment, how critical, what is the percentage of spelling as part of the assessment? Is it 10% of the whole collective score, or is it 2%? Are we checking spelling, or are we checking the ability to write, or both?
Chair Gelser and Representative Van Orman, that's an excellent question. Oregon has it's called a trait-based rubric, and one of those required traits is conventions, and one of the elements of conventions is spelling. In high school, that's double weighted. Conventions is double weighted. So it's spelling is considered a relatively It's not an insignificant portion of the rating. I couldn't give you an exact percentage, but it weighs in into the decision. The committee that we talked to of English language arts professionals were quite clear that students still need to know how to spell in order to use spell check effectively. So as you can see, if they use a homonym incorrectly, that the spell checker will not assist them, in which case their score would be reduced. But to the second part of your question is, are we interested in spelling, or are we interested in generally how do kids organize their thoughts and put them together and to make a coherent presentation or argument? We're definitely interested in both, as the trait describes, and we're still continuing that emphasis both in the state assessment and encouraging teachers as part of their curriculum and lesson plans to continue instruction along those routes, those lines.
Thank you. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as a writing teacher myself, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I think this is a very intelligent process that you're following here. And it seems to me that it's, I can understand that you ran it through the field because it seems very commonsensical. What it's going to catch is, you know, the individual who has written quickly, which we encourage students to do, to try to get their thoughts down. But maybe they've made some typos in there. Going back to Representative Van Orman's problem, it's not just people who are getting older who do that. You know, a lot of people do typos. Well, the spell checker will allow them to pick that up, but it won't, as you mentioned, Tony, deal with the homonyms. And the homonyms are really what reveal a serious problem with spelling. You know, is when students are coming up with words that kind of look like a word that they've seen, but it's not the word that they need. And so they're going to have to go through, you know, in the homonym list or the word list to come up with the right word. What this is really useful for, it seems to me, is those people who have some mild dyslexia, right, who will, you know, do some letter reversal and things like that, gives them a sort of real-world way to help identify those problems, but they still have to know what is the right way to spell the word. I think, you know, if it were the traditional Microsoft Word kind of system of, you know, where it just makes the change for you or, you know, highlights everything, increasingly including homonyms, I think that would be a real problem. I think this is a nice sort of balancing act. And I think that it does make sense for us to be encouraging more students and more districts to go in the direction of online, to really be encouraging them and to force districts as much as they can to be encouraging, you know, having the technology for students to have access to computers and to be ready for the real world. You know, I'm in the position where I teach students who are coming back to school after a number of years, as well as students who are fresh out of high school. And the difference between the two is dramatic in terms of their ability to use computers and technology. And so, you know, the more we can be encouraging that, the better.
Thank you. And the last word goes to Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciated the presentation because it hit probably about half of my questions. So those are taken care of, and thank you. And this is what I was trying to have in conversations recently with some of my school district folks, and they kind of struggled with this too, and I certainly do. And I'm almost struggling to ask the question because I'm not quite sure how to frame the question. But I keep going back to what tells us this is a good choice? What tells us this works well for kids and prepares them better? And it sounds like what I heard, and if I heard this wrong, please correct me, we're very possibly the first to do this in the country, statewide. So what tells us this is a good idea?
Madam Chair and Vice Chair Springer, I'll start, and then if Tony wants to add something, well, I would say that the fact that NAEP, the national test, is starting to use it, I think we're in very good company. That test is held in very high esteem in this country and is held up as the marker for judging how states are doing in a variety of subjects. And the fact that they are starting to incorporate it, and they're actually, I believe, starting to incorporate it at the fourth grade level, we're not. We're being more conservative and not starting it until the seventh grade level. I think that we are seeing that we see it as a tool, a 21st century tool, much as we've been using dictionaries and others. I would say that looking up words in a dictionary helps you spell. And pulling down on looking at the various ways that you spell a word on spell check helps you spell. And so I think it's learning how these tools really help support our students and help them really be able to provide them more freedom to be more expressive, to be able to summarize express themselves in the assignments that are given to them and the prompts that are given to them in tests and in the timelines that they're facing, as Representative Dembro pointed to, and really allows our students more freedom to focus on these other critical skills and expressing themselves in writing and using this tool to help them accomplish that. And giving us a different way of how we look at measuring those other high-level skills that we want to see in our students in their writing.
Okay. Brief follow-up?
Very brief.
Very brief. My concern with this is a couple of my colleagues have mentioned is I got a kid that struggles with this, and because we didn't have spell check, and don't as of yet, it has forced us to continue to work on the spelling and not just say, well, there's going to be a tool to adapt for that, so we don't need to focus so much on that and move forward. And I'm concerned that that will be lost in the process of, I only need to get to here, and I don't really have to worry about spelling too much because there's a tool that will do it for me. There's value in continuing to persevere in that skill.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Representative Springer, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. we are not saying that schools don't have to worry about spelling now that we're that they get access to spell check by any means. If anything, I mean, spelling is an essential skill, and we need to make sure that it continues to be a focus of our instruction in our schools at all levels, at all grade levels. And so I couldn't agree with you more that we can't just think that we don't need to address spelling because we have these high-tech tools available to us. It absolutely is an essential skill.
Thank you very much for taking the time to come today. The demonstration was very helpful. Thank you for the suggestion of the topic and making it happen. So we are going to switch our order briefly because we have Senator Hass here. Senator Hass, if you would come and join us. You all thought that the virtual school bill was long. You should see Senator Hass's bill on a higher education task force. Senator Hass, welcome.
Thank you. Mark Hass, Senate District 14. I'll be brief and make this informal. Three of you are on the higher ed task force, so I don't want to be too redundant. And I can also notice the look in the eyes of legislators who've been in a hearing for a long time. Just to put perspective on how we got to these task force recommendations that will be finalized at our final task force meeting tomorrow. If you go back 10 years, there was a lot of concern that the higher ed system was adrift and had no direction. And so our new governor at the time, Ted Kulongoski, appointed a very charismatic and powerful guy to the board of higher ed to be chaired and shake things up. And that was Neil Goldschmidt. And we all know how that worked out. Since that happened, nothing did change in higher ed. And it still sort of lacked direction and drifted, and probably saying that nothing happened is technically incorrect because things did happen. Which meant that we came closer to mediocrity, tuitions continued to go up, and there seemed to be no strategic synchronization with the needs of high school graduates in Oregon or with Oregon's economy. When I took over the chair of the Senate Education Committee in 2009, I saw some of these issues kind of in my face and saw that we needed to do something pretty quickly here to kind of right the ship and chart a course that makes more sense for the state. And so the leadership in the House and Senate, I went to them and with a few others, and we got a task force appointed that has an equal number of D's and R's, which I noticed is something that the House adheres to over here. And we started working earlier this year to look at some of the best practices around the country at what makes the most sense. And so we came up with three bills. The biggest one, LC 2861, in essence removes a lot of the red tape from our university system by making it a university and no longer a state agency. A lot of people are surprised to know that Oregon State University has to abide by the same rules as the Department of Corrections or the Department of Agriculture. If they want a variance and need a lawyer, they have to go through the Department of Justice. If they want a new roof on a dormitory, they have to go through the Department of Administrative Services. If they want to build a new dormitory, they have to come to the legislature. They lose a construction season, it ends up being more expensive. So it's a very complex bill, and we can get into it at whatever degree you want, but the notion is really pretty simple in that if the legislature can't give more money to the university system next biennium, and it looks like that will be the case, then let's at least make life a little bit easier for them by giving them some more flexibility and some more autonomy. So that's really the gist behind this big 400-page bill. And we did two other smaller but yet significant issues in the higher ed task force, issues that you're familiar with, known as dual credits, the practice of high schoolers earning college credits while they're still in high school. Most of us know this through AP courses. And the language in this bill would promote it and expand it so that we'll be available and provide opportunities to more kids. And the idea there is if kids can get college credits in the bank before they leave for school, it makes their college career much more affordable, and it also hooks them into a higher education career to begin with. And finally, LC 1287 puts the 40-40-20 goal into statute. And I know it sounds like it's just an aspirational thing and can't be enforced and all that, and that's true, but we think it serves a value in that it will act as a compass, so that it will help with decision-making down the road. If you want to put a veterinarian school at Portland State University, you look, okay, and ask, does this promote the 40-40-20 goal, or does this get us closer to 40-40-20? No, I don't think so, so let's put that on hold. If putting more money into the opportunity grant gets us there, okay, then let's do that. But it's there to serve as more of a compass. So those are the three bills. The idea is that it will be finalized in our task force tomorrow, and then it will be voted out of the Senate Education Interim Committee to be pre-session filed on Thursday. And I'm happy to take any questions on where we're going. Obviously, these drafts are still a little rough, although they've been drafted, you know, four or five times each, and obviously subject to more change as we go through the session.
Are there questions for Senator Haas?
I'm embarrassed to ask, Madam Chair, but could you re-explain the 40-40-20?
40% of residents have a bachelor's degree or higher, 40% have an associate's degree or higher, and 20% have a college or a high school GED equivalent, the rest. We're way below that now. And, you know, most of us went to the business summit yesterday, and I think the thrust of that is to improve Oregon's economic state. It's to raise our income level, the average income level, closer to the national average. And one of the ways you do that is you produce more college graduates.
Mm-hmm.
Washington is ahead of the national average, and one thing they have over Oregon is they have a higher percentage of college graduates up there.
Any further questions for Senator Haas? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. It's just a short one about the U of O is currently going through a reinvention process as well. So would this be similar? Would this be in conflict? Do you have any idea?
Yes. Thank you for that question. I should straighten that out. The University of Oregon has its own proposal,
right,
and it's not this one.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of a melding of what the Oregon University system wanted to do and what some national experts who worked with us very closely through this process said makes the most sense. The U of O proposal, which gives them much more autonomy and also seeks the issuance of a state bond, is a very significant and intriguing proposal. But I think in my mind, and I think the majority of the task force agree, that we need to do this first.
Okay.
And maybe look at that next.
Okay.
But this has to be first. I don't think they're in conflict necessarily, but this feels like, in terms of riding the ship, this is a pretty good foundation block.
Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up. So what's the level of buy-in from the Chancellor's office, presidents of various campuses around the state?
It's very strong. I think they'll issue some sort of statement tomorrow in support. We did do everything they wanted, and we added some things they didn't have in. But the gist of the big bill, LC 2861, was in the OUS proposal that came out sometime this summer that all seven university presidents signed on to. So they're very anxious to get this done, and they're very supportive.
Follow up?
Yeah. Thanks. Good. It's an enormous bill, obviously, and I haven't looked through it at all, but you may recall something that was brought to our attention or into this plan that came from the national experts who were involved in the process all the way through. Is there anything there that you could just throw out that might be something for us to be thinking about as we go
Sure.
forward prior to reading the however many hundred bills, page bill?
Yeah. We're one of the few states in the country that separates universities from community colleges. So one of the things that this big bill does is it creates a coordinating commission that has universities and community colleges sitting at the same table, which seems like a practical thing, and a lot of people are surprised that we don't do that now. And when we talked to the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, they were just shocked to find out that we didn't do that. And given the trend that you've seen over the last 10 years where more and more students are relying more and more on community colleges before they get to their universities, I think it's very important that we coordinate together. The size of PCC that has grown so much over the last decade, you know, in terms of students and real estate, it's bigger than Oregon State and Oregon. And I just think that there should be coordination between those.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, is 2861 what we've been hearing about the P20? Or is it something totally different?
Is it the what?
P20? The joint.
PK through 20.
Oh, Representative Huffman, that's a different concept. I know that Governor Kitzhaber has talked about that as a sort of a super investment board overarching everything. And that idea probably somewhere down the road could be morphed into this. But I think the most important part of all of this is to remove some of the regulations and burdens on these universities so that they can behave a little bit more nimbly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
For
I look forward
sharing
to working
some of your time.
With you on this.
Likewise. We'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Thank you. And our last item in terms of an informational hearing is an update on the Oregon Environmental Literacy Task Force with Tracy Price from the Freshwater Trust. Thank you for your flexibility in waiting.
Chair Gelzer, members of the committee, thank you for having me. For the record, my name is Tracy Price, and I have been working as the Education Director for the Freshwater Trust and had the pleasure of serving as the chair of our task force and the task force that was created through the No Oregon Child Left Inside Act that was passed last year, which established a task force to develop our state environmental literacy plan. And I just want to thank the committee for allowing this to happen and for your deliberations and the membership of the task force. We essentially started our work in January and on October 1st submitted our report, our plan, to the legislature. And this was unanimously accepted by all of the task force, you know, on behalf of the memberships and the agencies that we represent. So I hope that you will all find, you know, that this sort of pleases your interests. And I just wanted to tell you just a few brief things about it. So one thing that I wanted to share with you is that we are currently the third state in the nation with a completed environmental literacy plan. Every other state is really hustling to make these happen. If you ask folks from Maryland and Nebraska, which are the other two states with completed plans, they will definitely tell you that ours is the best so far. So this has been an opportunity for our state to really assume a leadership role in this. And other states are looking at what we've done and using this as a model for their own states. What's happening now, so the No Child Left Inside federal legislation is still pending, and they're attempting to amend the Elementary and Secondary Education Act to include environmental literacy. And if and when that happens, that's when federal funds would be available to help with the implementation or support with the implementation of this plan into our schools. But the good news is that this is actually already happening in our schools. And I would guarantee that in all of your districts, in some classrooms, in some of the schools, teachers and students are already engaging in these kinds of activities. So more than anything, this is also just validation for the good work that they're doing and how they're connecting students to their environments, the local community, and what happens when that starts to happen is schools break out of their silos and the communities end up supporting them in ways that they hadn't before. So there are opportunities not just with federal funding, but with state, with local support. We've actually had the Oregon Community Foundation come on board to support our work. When our legislation passed, it passed with no funding, and the Oregon Community Foundation came in and supported this work. And where we're at now, you know, the task force is essentially dissolved as of the next legislative session. But the members are really committed to continuing to work and see the recommendations in this plan move forward. And so the Oregon Community Foundation continues intends to continue supporting our work in doing this. So I just, it's a hopeful document that we have, and I really just wanted to take the time to thank you all on behalf of the task force for allowing this work to happen and answer any questions or comments that you might have. So, yeah.
Your questions, Representative Zimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one of the changes, if I remember right, that this committee suggested to the bill, and I think amended into the bill, had to do with adding somebody from forestry, somebody from agriculture, somebody from fisheries. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us, was that a good idea?
Absolutely. Yeah. So Chair Gelder and Representative Zimbro, yes. I mean, the 11 members who were sitting at the table represented a broader interest of Oregon, really. And our work is really focused on the legacy of Oregon and, you know, taking all of those factors into account. So I think having worked collaboratively on this plan and ended up with unanimous support for it should demonstrate to all of us that this is an issue that doesn't have to be, you know, polarizing. It can be something that brings us together. So I absolutely think it was good that happened.
Good. Madam Chair. Thank you. Point of clarification, Representative. So the discussion we had in the committee, and one of my requests, and the reason I voted no on it was because I was told no, and I pouted, and that was changed then in the task force to add members.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
I had not heard that, so I appreciate you bringing that up.
That was.
We did that in this committee.
Yeah, actually, it was in Ways and Means that it happened.
Mm-hmm. We did add members in this committee, though. It was the same day we passed the sex ed bill.
Well, my recollection
I don't remember adding.
I think it's maybe here.
With Representative Kopp and Representative Monroe.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's what I remember.
And they left the room, and they came back.
That we added
three. We added one of them.
And you, yes, there were originally three proposed members appointed by the Department of Education, and so those were then bumped back to one, and then a Department of Agriculture and the State Forester appointee and the State Marine Board were added.
At Ways and Means.
Because I remember.
I was going to say we did that in Ways and Means.
Yeah.
Okay, because I remember Arnie. I said. Yeah, mm-hmm. Wouldn't you want a member, you know, representing the Marine Board?
Mm-hmm. Testifying on that one.
Yep.
And I remember you voting no, but we added something.
But we changed it in Ways and Means.
And okay. Then I think it
okay.
Does.
Yeah. So. I didn't catch that part. I learned something.
When you voted on it on the floor, it was there.
Okay.
This is the sign of the end of a long meeting. Are there other questions before we consult with our historiographer?
Forgetting the victory.
No. Tracy, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Excuse me. We'll close our informational hearing of the Interim House Education Committee, and we are going to open a work session of Interim House Education, a work session of the Interim House Education Committee for the purpose of considering committee bills. So we have, colleagues, a large stack of bills which were sent to you. They are on the shared drive. At your pleasure, Representative Springer has the list. Generally, it's been a while since we've introduced committee bills. It's kind of tradition that it's a courtesy to introduce them. Your support of introducing them does not suggest your support of the concept or the bill later. It does not commit you to voting for or against it later. We could do this the origin of these bills are varied. Some come from members of this committee, some come from members not on the committee. The practice was basically if you have something, send it to Cheyenne and we will put it in. So Cheyenne and Victoria Cox have put together a catch line list. We could go through and discuss each of these bills one by one at length, or Representative Stringer could move forward with the motion. And that is at your pleasure.
Please do.
I move that you do that.
I second. It's dark out there.
Oh, well, please hold. So, Cheyenne, what were you saying?
Members, we've received notice via email, I believe, that there's another bill pending. So this motion can take place all in one go, and then we can have another motion okay. that adds that bill when we get the bill back down here.
Okay.
Or if you all want to wait, we can do that.
Great. And one of these was going to be at the request of Governor Ted Kulongoski, is that correct? So that, and does that need to be in the motion for LC 3121?
We've just added that, yes, by right. hand, and it's not LC 3121 is not on the summary we prepared, but it's the dais for everyone. We've just written it in on the motion.
But does that need to be part of the motion that the bill back includes? So maybe we could do that one as a first motion on its own.
Okay, so you want 3121 as a single motion?
As a single motion at the request of Governor Ted Kulongoski, and then we would move on to the rest of them.
Okay.
Does that work?
Chair Gelser, I move that the following, that LC 3121 dated 12/14/2010 from Governor Ted Kulongoski be introduced as committee bills.
Representative Springer moves that LC 3121 dated 12/14/2010 be introduced as a committee bill at the request of Governor Ted Kulongoski. Is there any discussion? Are there any...
Can you tell us what it is?
Yeah. No. Mark, would you like to come and tell us what it is?
Just the highlight.
My understanding was it was coming into the email as I came down and...
Yes, that is correct. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Margie Lau, Education Policy Advisor for Governor Kulongoski. And you're probably all aware that we did kind of a Chapter 2 for the reset report and just released that a few weeks ago. And included in that were some additional recommendations for education. The LC that happened just as... the committee was convening this afternoon is one that would require basically a maintenance of effort for the length of the school year in how districts plan initially at the start of preparing their budgets. We all certainly recognize that unfortunately sometimes as we plan things happen and those don't carry through all the way. And so the bill allows an exception if there's a loss of revenue that reduces the amount of state school fund that's available to the district that would allow them to have a school year that's less than what the state's minimum requirement is. But we would ask that all districts plan for a full school year as they begin their budget process. And so that's basically what that bill does. The second bill, if I could...
Oh, is there a second one?
Yes, I think the other one just came in.
All right, LC 3122.
So can she explain that now, or do we have to move off of this motion before we can talk about something else? Because we're in a motion. Yeah, I think we need to. So can you hold tight for just a second?
Certainly.
And then we'll do that as a separate motion, then we'll okay. do the big motion. But is there any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the introduction of LC 3121? Seeing none, the motion carries and the bill will be introduced. Representative Springer, 3122, and this would also be on behalf of Governor Kulongoski.
Chair Gelser, I move that LC 3122 on behalf of Governor Ted Kulongoski be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Springer moves that LC 3122 dated 12/14 be introduced as a committee bill at the request of Governor Ted Kulongoski. Is there any discussion? Marjorie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Marjorie Lau with the Governor's Office. This was a second component of what was included in the Reset 2.0 report, and that has to do with a lot of the discussion that's been occurring around the Capitol about education service districts, their governance and their funding and their assigned responsibilities. The education task force met for several months and reviewed a lot of those different proposals, and the place where we found the greatest consensus was around three topics. One, that the governance structure should be composed of the resident superintendents of the education service district rather than separately elected community board members. Second, that rather than trying to remap, which there have been several sessions that have tried to look at ways in which to reconfigure the boundaries for education service districts, and there's just been a lot of difficulty in finding the way in which to do that. the group that we were working with, which included a lot of education stakeholders, instead encouraged more of a market-based approach where we would allow school districts to look to purchasing those services from any education service district or other local education agency to meet the needs of the students in their district, figuring that that would encourage more consolidation of functions that are not specific geography-based duties, and also a lot more emphasis of statewide services and expertise in different subjects by different ESDs. And then the third piece was to allow a reduction in the amount of the funding that goes to ESDs and elimination of the, or at least a phase out of the minimum award size to an ESD. Presently, statute assures all ESDs of a minimum annual award amount of $1 million from the state school fund. We would eliminate over time that $1 million and move to a process where their share of the state school fund is 4% instead of 4.75.
Thank you very much. Is there further discussion on the introduction of LC 3122? Representative Cobb?
Thank you, and Ms. Lowell can tell me whether I'm wrong or right, but and I don't know if you've seen the bill, I drafted a bill on the governance for the ESDs, but does not have, it's identical to the first 2 points that she is sharing from the RESET committee, but it doesn't deal with the financial piece. So if they see another bill that looks like that,
that's why. Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Margie, on the ESD model, there's no proposal of eliminating any ESDs then that are currently in place.
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, no, we're not eliminating or consolidating any of the districts. We're just encouraging more of a market-driven model for letting districts choose who's going to be the provider.
We could have gotten this done last session if, yeah. But
really?
Yes, we could have.
All right.
That's right.
We're drifting back into our reminiscing. is there any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the introduction of LC 3122 as a committee bill at the request of Governor Korogoski? Seeing none, the motion passes and LC 3122 will be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you very much.
Representative Springer, are you ready to sit back and
And just to reiterate, just because I'm making the motion doesn't mean I necessarily endorse any of these concepts. But maybe I do. Chair Gelser, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 252, dated 6-24-10. LC 399, dated 6-10-10. LC 913, dated 8-16-10. LC 1042, dated 7-19-10. LC 1331, dated 10-29-10. LC 1358, dated 12-8-10. LC 1359, dated 11-26-10. LC 1421, dated 10-20-10. LC 1422, dated 10-20-10. LC 1423, dated 10-12-10. LC 1542, dated 10-19-10. LC 1548, dated 12-3-10. LC 1552, dated 11-8-10. LC 1553, dated 11-8-10. LC 1554, dated 11-12-10. LC 1555, dated 11-12-10. LC 1556, dated 11-12-10. LC 1557, dated 11-17-10. LC 1558, dated 11-15-10. LC 1559, dated 12-3-10. LC 1638, dated 9-22-10. LC 1895, dated 11-10-10. LC 2208, dated 12-1-10. LC 2246, dated 12-2-10. LC 2255, dated 12-10-25-10. LC 2341, dated 12-10-10. LC 2520, dated 11-12-10. LC 2521, dated 10-26-10. LC 2553, dated 11-3-10. LC 2555, dated 11-1-10. LC 2557, dated 10-26-10. LC 2558, dated 10-20-10. LC 2621, dated 11-24-10.
Good job.
Good.
Representative Springer moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 252, dated 6-24-10, LC 399, dated 6-10-10, LC 913, dated 8-16-10, LC 1042, dated 7-19-10, LC 1331, dated 10-29-10, LC 1358, dated 12-8-10, LC 1359, dated 11-26-10, LC 1421, dated 10-20-10, LC 1422, dated 10-20-10, LC 1423, dated 10-12-10, LC 1542, dated 10-19-10, LC 1548, dated 12-3-10, LC 1552 dated 11-8-10, LC 1553 dated 11-8-10, LC 1554 dated 11-12-10, LC 1555 dated 11-12-10, LC 1556 dated 11-12-10, LC 1557 dated 11-17-10, LC 1558 dated 11-15-10, LC 1559 dated 12-3-10, LC 1638 dated 9-22-10, LC 1895 dated 11-10-10, LC 2208 dated 12-1-10, LC 2246 dated 12-2-10, LC 2255 dated 10-20 LC 2341 dated 12-10-10, LC 2520 dated 11-12-10, LC 2521 dated 10-26-10, LC 2553 dated 11-3-10, LC 2555 dated 11-1-10, LC 2557 dated 10-26-10, LC 2558 dated 10-20-10, and LC 2621 dated 11-24-10. Is there any discussion? Representative Huffman.
LC 1548, what was the date on that again?
LC 1548 is dated 12-3-10, my mother-in-law's birthday.
Okay. Thank you. I wanted to see if you could do it. You did it pretty quickly, actually. Thank you.
It's the testing.
You know how to fill in the bubbles?
No, I used the date checker.
Oh.
You passed the assessment.
Date checker. Any further discussion? Seeing none. Oh, is there any objection? Seeing none, then the motion passes, and we will have all of these bills as Education Committee-sponsored bills next session. And I will close the work session on the introduction of committee bills and open an informational hearing of the Interim House Education Committee on the acknowledgement of departing members. So this is the part where we acknowledge departing members. And so everyone is, our committee itself is disbanding as we know it, and I wanted to take a minute to thank all of you for agreeing to come back in the interim. I believe we may be the only committee in the chamber that had the same membership in the interim as it did during the session, and that was a great pleasure to get to work with all of you for a period of an entire 2 years, and I will miss the chance to work with all of you, and personally wanted to extend my thanks to each of you for your patience with long meetings and difficult subjects. We certainly have had some hairy ones in here, and this committee has never failed to ask intelligent questions, to spar openly when we've disagreed on issues, but everyone has done so respectfully. I've always looked forward to coming to this committee and working with each of you, and so thank you all very much for the chance to do that. And to Representative Van Orman, you will be sorely missed.
Thank you.
In 2011. You have brought such grace, such good questions, and wisdom to the work of the legislature, and such a passion for children and education. And I heard it rumored that you ran a Head Start program for 25 years.
25, it seems like 25, but it was 22.
It was 22, but thank you for bringing all of that experience to bear.
And I'm making her continue to work on Head Start issues.
Yeah, that's true.
And Representative Maurer, your insightful questions and persistence and intelligence, you will be so missed. I've enjoyed working with you on this committee and the Healthcare Committee and the Human Services Committee, and I will really miss having you as a friend and colleague in the body, and I understand you are maybe not domiciling within the borders of our state.
Yes, that is correct. You know what? I said I had to get a real job, and I got a real job. But it's not in Oregon. It's in Washington.
Does your family get to stay here?
D.C. My family will move sometime in the summer. The kids will stay in school through the school year.
So tell us about your new job.
I'm working for the Department of Veteran Affairs. I'll be working on Capitol Hill as a congressional liaison.
Oh, congratulations.
Cool. We'll be solving problems as opposed to creating them.
Yeah. Can I give you my claim number? And you can
contact your congressman.
Can he use your name?
Won't mean anything. No, it's been a lot of fun. Yeah, I do miss this place. Shoot, we had all sorts of fun. I have to disagree, though. We weren't always cordial, Madam Chair. My shins under here, you know, it gets pretty...
Well, you're sitting next to her
who sits there.
Yeah,
I know. Oh, no, it was Arnie.
Yeah.
You're pummeled with the chocolates under there?
Yeah. No, it's been fun.
Yeah,
everybody ought to run for a state office. Right? I mean, a state legislator. Mm-hmm. What an honor. Mm-hmm. When you're sitting on this side, the pressure's a little different than when you're mm-hmm. out there.
Yeah. If more people did it, they might be a little more understanding of what we do.
Well, yeah. I'm not sure they would. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure they would. But you know, I mean, gosh, the fraternity and the sorority of this body's really not that big.
Yeah.
And
that's true.
You know, so it is, it's been an honor. You may not have heard the last of me, though. Because you move away doesn't mean you can't move back.
That's right.
I'm not selling my house.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. And as a parting gift, for the first time ever and only, we are complete 20 minutes early, but first must thank Hannah, who drafted every single one of those bills on that long list and worked very hard to get those turned back around in time for pre-session filing. And I know many of you have individual bills too, so thank you to Hannah and all the folks down in Legislative Council. Thanks to Cheyenne and Debbie and Victoria, who helped get ready for today. We've been blessed with great committee staff. And with that, the House Committee on Education is adjourned.